Okay, this is Jonathan Bernstein. We're conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Jim Holt. Today is, what is today? November 12th, 2001. It is approximately 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And, Mr. Holt, could you start, by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay, how far back you want to go?
Just growing up.
Well, I grew up in East Texas. I was born in 46, September 24th of 46. Actually, it says on my birth certificate, Saltillo, Texas, and the reason why I say that is because I was adopted at about the age of, 13, 14 months. And I'd always looked for Saltillo, and I thought it'd be down in the border area of Texas, and turns out it's up in north central Texas. I finally located the town I was supposedly born in, but I was in Longview, Texas. That's where my parents were from, and like I said, was adopted over there, grew up there. I was an only child. My parents had had one other child, and he was kind of killed in a freak accident, and there was no chance of another child. So I was always told that I was adopted, and they made it a special deal and everything. So I always knew it, and I always thought it was kind of a special deal. And I guess I had a normal childhood. Grew up spoiled, probably a little bit. My mother was a registered nurse. She was county and state nurse for her entire career. Did other home nursing on the side sometimes for people. My dad worked for the railroad. In fact, he worked 51 years for the Texas and Pacific Railroad. The time he retired, I think there was one man between St. Louis and El Paso, Texas, that had more seniority than my dad. Most of the time, he was an engineer. So I grew up early on. My dad was on the road. There was a lady named Creola Davis that my parents hired fairly early on that was just like a second mother to me. It was a black lady that I guess you could say she was a maid, but she was a lot more than that because she mother worked, dad worked. She took care of me before I went to school, after I'd get home from school, once I was going to school. So it was just like another parent. I always called her my black mother and everything. In fact, I was a singer. My mother early on discovered that I had an affinity for music, and she started me on voice lessons when I was 5 years old, and so I was real involved in church music and singing around the community for various groups like the Masons and the Eastern Star and stuff like that. So I grew up doing that and being involved in that all the way up through school, and actually kind of how I got in college, because I wasn't what you'd call a super great student. Made decent grades, but nothing that would get you in Yale or Harvard or anything like that. And I got a music scholarship to North Texas State University and took that. And that kind of indirectly led into my Vietnam stuff, because first time away from home, really. And I got up to Denton, where North Texas is, and North Texas was a big party school then. And I got involved in the party scene and actually didn't do much except go to the music classes that I had, and the rest of them I kind of blew off. And so I got in some trouble and stuff like that, and they asked me if I wouldn't consider going someplace else. And then was enrolled in Kilgore College, which was back down in East Texas near Longview, and everything. Was still trying to party and didn't do real well there either. And so by early 1966. I'd been kicked out of two colleges and pretty much knew that I was probably going to get drafted and go in the military. Mm-hmm. So at that point in time, I decided to maybe join the military because I'd heard that the best thing to do was to join because you'd get, you know, at least some sort of choice in, mm-hmm. in your training and stuff. So that kind of leads up to that. I don't know if that's enough on biographical or not. Like I said, my childhood was normal. I never had what you'd call any bad trouble in my childhood or anything like that. The normal childhood diseases, mm-hmm. And everything. My parents were not what you'd call overtly patriotic, but I was raised, you know, I was in the Scouts, you know, got a lot of patriotism in the Boy Scouts, went up through their organization and everything. So it was one of those things that I was patriotic, you know, without thinking about it much. It was just kind of a given. You see all the movies on TV, you know, the John Wayne stuff, mm-hmm. and everything. I saw all of that growing up. I remember real vividly, I wasn't what you'd call someone that got sick very often, but in junior high, I was sick. I think I had glandular fever or something like that. Mm-hmm. Was out for a week or so, and I was home when Kennedy was shot, and I saw all of that on TV, and I think that made a big impact on me, the response of the nation and everything like that. That's a real vivid memory to me of watching all of that, and of course the replay of his speeches and various things, because I probably hadn't paid much attention to it until that time. And I guess that was probably the thing that really got me to thinking more and more about, you know, countries and service and stuff like that. So I can really say I don't know that I'd heard much about Vietnam, you know, in high school. I was real involved in music and all this various things and shows and stuff like that, so I probably wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to what was going on in Southeast Asia at that time, and didn't really start focusing on it, I guess, until such time as you get kicked out of two colleges and people start talking about the draft and everything. And I remember I still have my draft card that says 1A on it, you know, and everything. When I got that, I knew pretty well that I was on my way. And I had a friend that we had grown up together, and we were always going to go in the Marines together. You know, you have these childhood fantasies, and we were going to go in the Marines, and we were going to then get out of the Marines after an indeterminate amount of time and become Texas Rangers. That was our childhood dream. And of course, you know, with no thought whatsoever about how you go about doing all this stuff. But when it came my time, you know, I kind of thought about the Marines, and I even got in touch with my friend Danny, and he was still hanging on in college by his teeth, and he wasn't ready to join. And of course, through some of this Kennedy stuff that had happened, I'd started hearing about the Green Berets. So I thought, that sounds real interesting, you know. And of course, you never think about it. You know, I kind of grew up, I was chubby, you know, I wore glasses. You know, I wasn't what you'd call a jock or anything like that. So you kind of wonder why I even thought at the time that I could do something like that. But I guess it was one of those things that I'd always been raised to tell myself that I could do anything that I decided I was going to do. So in my mind, I thought, well, I may try to join the military and see if I can get Green Berets. And of course, I brought that up to the Army recruiter when I went in to talk to him, and of course, he didn't really tell me that there was a process other than I'd have to go to airborne, you know, school. So I kind of put that down on as one of my choices and everything, and the fact that I wanted combat arms, you know, and everything. Well, I didn't find out until years later that my mother, being county and state nurse, she knew all the people that sat on the local selective service board.
Mm-hmm.
Because really and truly, I didn't figure it out till later, but, you know, there were people from my hometown and the area around Longview that were getting kicked out of college or weren't going to college, and guys were going like that.
Mm.
You know, and I get kicked out of college, you know, two colleges. It's the middle of April, somewhere around in there, and I'm not getting the draft notice.
Hmm.
You know, and I went down and talked to the Army recruiter and pretty much kind of signed a letter of intent or something they called it, you know, that I was going to join the Army. But what we're going to do is we're going to wait till my draft notice came, you know, then he would contact them and say that I had joined, and that would kind of cancel out the draft part of it, and then I would go on in. Well, I didn't get my draft notice until like the end of July, 1st of August, somewhere around in there, you know. And I, like I said, I found out years later that my mother had kind of gone and talked to some of these people that she knew on the local draft board, and they kind of slid me to the bottom of the list, so to speak, you know. But the point was finally reached where, you know, there was no choice because I wasn't going to school, I wasn't married, I was essentially just working, you know, at some jobs. I'd finally gone to work, got a job at Sears and was working for them, you know, which was an okay job, but, you know, it wasn't anything that was going to keep me out of the draft by any stretch of the imagination. So finally the draft came and everything, and I went over to Shreveport and took my physical and stuff like that, and it was, I think, middle of August or towards the end of August that I finally went in the military, you know, and everything. And of course, because I had signed up for combat arms and everything, well, they sent me to Fort Pope, Louisiana.
Mm.
And once I got down to Fort Pope, that's when things got serious because I started realizing I had a real good friend in high school that his father was a retired colonel in the Army, and he knew what a knucklehead I was. And I'll never forget, he called me in before I was supposed to leave, go down to Fort Polk. I was over visiting my friend, and he called me into his kind of his study that he had at the house and said, "You need to understand something about what you're fixing to do." He said, "I know how you are and everything, and you're kind of boisterous and loud-mouthed and have a tendency to pop off and stuff like that." And he said, "You can't do that in the military." He said, "You need to keep your mouth shut and do what you're told all the time and listen to what these drill instructors are going to tell you, because if you don't, they'll break you, or you'll get a reputation of being a knucklehead or a wise ass or whatever, and you know, they'll just mess with you all the time." And he said, "You need to just learn to keep your mouth shut and do what you're told." Well, we got to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and it was like middle of the night. I mean, it was after midnight by the time the bus got down there. And I'll never forget, you know, and they had these people coming on the bus and screaming at us and stuff like that. And, of course, I figured it out later that they were just corporals or acting corporals or stuff like that, that the real sergeants didn't stay up till midnight or whatever, but these people were still, you know, wearing uniforms and stuff like that, and being real officious and everything. And I just decided I was going to do what Miss Brown told me to do. I was going to keep my mouth shut and see how it went and everything, and not try to be a smart aleck about everything and stuff. So basic training actually went pretty good for me. You know, of course, after we'd been at Pope for a while, you know, we started hearing about Tigerland, which was like right across the road from where we were, was this AIT that they called Tigerland. And the deal, everybody was told, even by our sergeants, that if you graduate basic and you get orders to Tigerland, you're going to Vietnam as soon as you finish Tigerland, because that was infantry advanced training for Vietnam. But they give you all these tests when you first get in the Army and at your basic training. And I've always been pretty good at like what you'd call intelligence tests or multiple choice or tests where you had to figure things out and stuff like that. And evidently I did fairly well with all the tests they gave us. I never knew what my scores were or anything, but I later found out that I had qualified for, like, be good enough to be trained in artillery, which required a little bit more, I guess, education or thought or whatever. And I'd also qualified for a possibility to go to officer candidate school. So that's two things. And then I don't remember what week it was in basic, but at some point in basic training they had some Green Berets show up and gave us a spiel about the Berets, and they gave us some tests, and they were an intelligence test. It was a battery of about five tests. It took nearly half a day to take all this stuff, and anyway, I qualified for that also and everything. But I guess the biggest thing about basic with me was I was a little overweight, and some of the physical stuff was a little hard. But about the second week in basic or something like that, they sent a whole bunch of us from my platoon or from my company down to take tests for drivers. And my bunkmate was a National Guard guy, because we had National Guard and Reserve and guys like myself. And that was another thing about basic too. It depended on your prefix to your serial number as to how you were treated. Because National Guard was treated like dirt, because everybody knew, the sergeants knew, and everybody, they were just coming in for their basic training and then they was going back home.
Some weekend warriors,
you know. Then a little bit better, the guys were treated were the guys that were what they called, let's see, ERs or IRs. Well, anyway, it was the guys that was a reserve. They were treated a little better. And then the guys that were U.S. prefix, those were the draftees. And they were treated a little better, but they were still, you know, they had to be drafted. Well, me, because I joined, I had an RA, which stood for Regular Army, in front of my thing, and they treated us a little. You didn't really notice a whole lot, but you did notice sometimes that they'd tend to not ride the RAs as much or something like that. You could sense it more than actually see it. It wasn't real overt and everything, but you could tell that was happening. Like, well, sometimes they'd line us up and they'd put the RAs up in front of the line or something like that and everything. But anyway, they sent us all down to take this driving test, and because my bunkmate was National Guard, he had already had some driving and taken this test in the past and knew what it was going to be like, and he talked to me and told me a bunch of stuff, and ended up, he and I were the only two that passed the test. out of about 15 or 20 that they sent down, we were the only ones that passed the test. So basic training was real slick for me, because essentially I was either driving the captain or the aid vehicle, or he was driving one or the other. Anytime we walked anywhere, one of us was driving. So we didn't walk. So it was like, you know, I got to the end of basic and I almost didn't pass my PT test to get out of basic, because I hadn't had enough walking and exercise to get me out of some of the stuff. But I did pass it by the skin of my teeth. I look back now and basic was fun. Mm-hmm. I liked throwing grenades. I liked low crawling. I liked all that stupid stuff, you know, and ate it up, you know, as far as listening, focusing on what they were telling us, you know, because more and more we were, and my two drill instructors were Vietnam vets.
I was actually about to ask.
They had already been to Vietnam. And some of the other, we noticed in a couple of the other platoons of our company that some of their drill instructors were just old time drill instructors, and they just rode the guys all the time unmercifully. But our DIs, they rode us, but they also taught us.
They did.
They'd get us aside and say, "You screwed up, and here's what it means, you know. Mm-hmm. This will get you killed if you do it. You know, this is why we're teaching you this." And I'll never forget that. And, you know, I can't even remember their names. But, you know, if I saw either one of them, I'd know them and I'd kiss them, because they really did. They taught us some stuff that probably, you know, you remembered later on that helped you and everything like that. But anyway, I got out of basic and got my orders, and my orders were for Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And a lot of the guys went to Tigerland, you know, but I got these orders for Fort Sill, and I didn't know what it was all about until I got there and everything. And I didn't even get to go home on leave. They just sent us, put us on a bus there at Polk and sent me to Fort Sill. And I get to Fort Sill, and they were doing this thing called an OCS prep AIT. And what they had done is they'd taken all these guys that had passed this test and were qualified for OCS and qualified for artillery. And from what I understand, it was a fairly new deal. And they were going to teach us the artillery stuff in the AIT, which is your advanced training, mm-hmm. and everything, but they were going to treat us like we were preparing to go to OCS. In other words, everybody in this company that I ended up in at Fort Sill was all supposed to be eventually going to OCS. So instead of having drill instructors, we had brand new lieutenants just out of OCS.
Oh boy, that must have been fun.
And it was a mess. They started us off the first morning I was there. I mean, they pulled us out. It was 5 something in the morning, and we took off running. And I tell people, and I'm pretty sure this is right, or pretty close to the schedule, we ran like the first 2 weeks, we ran a mile in the morning. The second 2 weeks, we ran a mile in the morning and a mile in the afternoon. And then the next 2 weeks or so, we ran 2 miles in the morning, and the next one, 2 miles in the morning, two in the afternoon. And then the last, we were running 3 miles in the morning and 3 miles in the afternoon. And I went from like 200 pounds down to 145 pounds in 8 weeks. And I tried to quit a couple of times, you know, and we found out later, because what they did is the first 6 weeks you were there, you were considered like lower class. And then the last 2 weeks you were there, you became like upper class, and we found out later that the upper class people, once we became one, had so many of the lower class guys that they were watching out for and stuff, and when they'd try to quit or something like that, we were supposed to go talk them out of it. And everything was kind of a mentor to them or whatever, and everything. But it was a mess because we did all the stuff that the guys did in OCS as far as the physical stuff and everything, and they made us really toe the line. All the stuff I thought I knew about how to polish shoes and do stuff like that, but we learned stuff there, you know, that they made us do like they did in OCS and stuff, and we had to, everything had to be just so and everything, much more than basic training. And everything. And of course, we finally became a kind of a unit and started, you know, working against. I'll never forget, they fell us out one morning, this lieutenant, and there was something wrong with the barracks, you know, a footprint someplace or something, and he had us out, and it was mist and rain and cold, and he had us out doing push-ups in the company street, and somebody in the back of the platoon started singing the Mickey Mouse song. And all of us finally took it up, and he kept us doing push-ups until nobody could push up anymore, but we never stopped singing. Wow. And he finally got disgusted and walked away, and from that time on, we pretty much became a unit and started working together. My mother, being a nurse, had taught me how to make hospital corners on a bed. And even in basic training, they come in the first morning and they're tearing up everybody's bed, and when the sergeant got to mine, it kind of shook him because I already had hospital corners on the bed, you know, but it still wasn't good, and he tore it up. But, you know, by the time I got to sale, I was pretty good at it. So, well, we'd have a big barracks inspection or stuff like that on the weekends. I'd make everybody's bed, at least on the ground floor. And then there was other guys that were better at polishing boots, and they'd polish everybody's boots, you know, and we worked together that way and stuff. But I got out of AIT, I finally graduated from that, and, you know, and like I said, I'd also qualified, you know, and I'd signed up for airborne and had taken those special forces tests. So I had that in the back of my mind, you know, but I still consider an OCS, you know. So I graduate and get to go home for, I think I got a couple of weeks or something like that. But anyway, I got assigned to what we called a gun buddy battery, which was another training area there at Fort Sill, and I was going to be an acting corporal. Oh, and in the meantime of all of this, I'd finally become a pretty good trooper and had become a private first class and everything. I think there in AIT was where I got PFC and everything. AD2 out of basic, I think that was where that went or something. I can't remember some of that stuff. But anyway, I was a PFC, and I get to this training unit and essentially was told that I was going to be an acting corporal helping a sergeant train a platoon of these guys that fired the guns, you know, and everything. Well, the sergeant I got paired up with had 20 some odd years in the military, lacked about 6 months, I think, of having his 30 years. And he didn't give a shit. And he essentially told me, he said, as far as I'm concerned, this platoon's yours. You do what you want to. I'll give you the schedule of what we're supposed to do. I'll get us lined out in the morning, and then if anybody wants me, I'll be over someplace, you know. He was cruising, in other words, for the last 6 months or 4 months of his military or something. He was going to cruise and everything. And so I essentially got handed this platoon, and I guess I did okay because the guys liked me, and I remembered the way our guys in basic had done stuff, you know. And we did what we needed to do and did the training we needed to train. But, you know, I would not spend all my time screaming at them and stuff like that. I'd just say, look, we got to do this. Let's do it. You know, can I get some volunteers? And, you know, or you guys are going to have to do this, so get after it, you know, and if we get through with it, then we'll take a break or whatever. And I didn't ride their butt, but I made sure we got stuff done. So, for too long, I was promoted to corporal, you know, and got hard stripes. And I kept seeing around post, plus the ones we'd had in this AIT thing, these second lieutenants that were idiots. Mm-hmm. I mean, they thought they were God, but they were idiots, you know. They didn't seem to know their ass from a hole in the ground, a lot of them and their stuff. But I don't know, I was starting to get soured on the idea of OCS. And see, what was happening then, the way I understood it, they had so many lieutenants going through this OCS at Fort Sill because they had so much need for these lieutenants over in Vietnam,
right,
that they had a waiting list, you know, of people to start OCS, and essentially that's what I was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting waiting to go, waiting on orders to go and everything, but in the meantime, they've got me doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I started liking it, you know, because, hey, I got up in the morning, you know, essentially I had my own room in the barracks. They didn't inspect me anymore, you know. Nobody jacked with me. The sergeant didn't jack with me. The officers didn't jack with me. My platoon was doing good.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing their job, so nobody messed with me, and I liked it. I was going, why should I go subject myself to another, you know, night lunch or whatever the hell. I can't even remember what OCS was supposed to be back then. I think it was like 3 months.
Mm, 90 days. Yeah.
You know, why should I subject myself to this bullshit? So I started going down. You know, you find out things as you kind of get a little further in the hierarchy and you learn the ways in the military. You know, well, they have this building there at Fort Sill, and that's where all the record clerks are and people that cut the orders and do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I found out who the clerk was that was supposed to be working on my stuff. And I went down and told him, I said, you know, blow it off. I don't want to go to OCS, you know. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and cut my orders for jump school, you know, so I can go on Benning and start that, you know, process. And of course, by this time, I knew that, you know, you just didn't say you were going to go to bring berets. You had to go to jump school, pass that, then, you know, maybe, you know, get a chance then. And of course, the fact that I'd already passed the mental test stuff, well, that gave me a shot at least, you know. So I'm still thinking that. Well, in the meantime, this girl that I knew from way back when in high school was living in Dallas, and I was driving down there just about every weekend from Fort Sill and visiting with her and stuff like that. And we had a big fight one weekend, and I'd been jacking with this clerk trying to get him to send me on to Benning for a long time, and everything. We had this big fight, and I was mad at her and mad at the world and everything. And I came back and I told this clerk that next Monday morning, I said, listen, asshole, if you're not going to send me to jump school, why don't you just send me to Vietnam?
Oof.
Very foolish remark. And essentially, that's how I volunteered for Vietnam.
Mm.
Without even really realizing I volunteered for Vietnam, that was enough for him. And so I get my orders, you know, a couple of 3 weeks later there at SEAL, you know, for the 11th Armored Cav in Vietnam. And that was right on, I still have those orders too. That was right on my orders. And I started asking people, and nobody knew who the 11th Cav was. Nobody'd heard of them.
Really?
You know, well, I finally figured it out. You think the time period we're talking by this time, this is just very early, you know, or I guess let's say, well, it's probably about May of 67. You see, the 11th Cav just got in Vietnam in August of 66. And most of the people in SEAL, you know, didn't really know them that much or anything like that. And everything, nobody really heard of, you know, because they hadn't been there as long as, you know, a few of the other units had or anything like that. Nobody knew who they were. But, you know, I could see on the orders were the Howitzer Battery, you know, 1st Squadron, 11th Armored Cav Regiment, Long Gal, Vietnam, the whole nine yards, and everything. Well, in the meantime, we had this commander of this gun bunny unit was a Green Beret that had served 2 tours in Vietnam, and they told him he was not going to do another Vietnam tour until he just did a normal command tour in the States. And he got stuck in this as captain of this training outfit for a while, and he was still trying to get back to Vietnam. Well, you know, and he got his orders about the same time I did. And this guy was something else. He was Hispanic. I guess he was about 5'10", something like that. Stocky, just built like a brick wall, you know. And he'd get out when we were doing the PT tests and stuff with these trainees. You know, he'd get out there and run the course backwards and stuff with them, you know, to show them, you know, kind of inspire them and stuff like that, and run with them, you know, and everything. He was a good commander as far as taking care of his stuff, but I'll never forget, he brought me in right before I was fixing to leave, to go home on leave for Vietnam, and threw one of these little first aid packs across the table, his desk, at me, you know, and he talked real gruff, you know. He said, "Corporal Hope, this is your going away present from me for take with you to Vietnam," you know. And I thought, well, that's strange. Why would you give me a dressing pack, you know, because that's what it was. One of these things that you carry a bandage in and everything. So he had me open it up, and I opened it up, and inside was one of these boar bristle shaving brushes that you use to lather up, you know, and lather your face with, and a can of Army gun oil. And he told me in his own profane way that if every time that I was out in Vietnam and we stopped, he said, before I pissed, before I lit a cigarette, before I did anything, I'd take that brush and put some oil on it and clean my weapon, he'd see me later. And somewhere back in East Texas, I still have that thing, and the bristles are about a quarter of an inch long now, you know. But I did what he said, and he's another one that I thank, because every time that I did anything in Vietnam, you know, any sort of dismount or stuff like that, and we took some sort of break, I'd take out that thing and I'd clean the gunk and stuff off my M16, and I never had a misfire. But he was also good to the cadre up there, because we had breaks in between some of these training cycles while I was there, and he let his cadre go down and train fire on some of the weapons and stuff. So I got to fire M60s and 50 calibers and 45s and a lot of different things that I probably wouldn't have got a chance to fire, you know, not being in an infantry unit or anything like that. He allowed us to do some of that stuff.
You didn't have any of that in basic?
Well, we had basic, you know. at that time, all we trained on the M14.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd never seen an M16 until I got to SEAL, and we didn't train on the 50s or 60s either one. That was in AIT once you went to advanced training. So I never, you know, messed with either one of those and everything. And the M79 had never had a chance to fire it until I got a chance. In fact, that was a funny thing. When we got to train fire with those, we went out to the range, and for some reason or another, the M79 just felt right with me. And they had a bunch of old tank bodies out on the range, and of course they'd been hit so many times that there was like holes knocked in the side of them. Well, I was sitting there firing this M79, and I'd pumped out a few rounds and kind of got the feel for it, and just as the captain walked up behind me, I put one through this hole in this side of this tank, you know.
Wow.
And he, "Bet you can't do that again, Corporal Hope." I said, "Bet I can, sir. $20 and sure." And I got lucky and I put another one right through the hole in the side of the tank, and he paid me and walked on off, you know, and everything. But that's the way he was, you know. He was cool. I never knew what happened to him. I looked for his name on the wall and hadn't found it and everything, but I'll never forget him because he was kind of one of these guys that, you know, he really seemed to care about his people that served under him and everything. So, but anyway, that's when I got, you know, my orders to Vietnam, and that was like, oh, I guess around the 1st of June of 67 there at SEAL. And everything. In fact, it's real interesting. I met a guy here at Tech. I've got his card at home, but he works. He may work here in this building or whatever. He's come to some of our meetings and stuff like that. But I heard him telling a story, and he went through the same thing I did of waiting at SEAL and going to the OCS prep. And that's the first guy that I've ever met that had gone through that same sort of BS, you know, of the OCS prep platoon and then having to wait for OCS. I think he went on to OCS, but, you know, I decided not to. And I kind of liked being a corporal and everything and stuff. But can we take a break?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Just stop a second.
Yeah, sure. Okay, we're back. So, I guess, stepping back to training, the DIs or Vietnam vets, I'm sure, helped quite a bit. Did you have any, did they do any mock villages setups or anything like that?
Actually, and I'm trying to remember, but I don't think I got any sort of Vietnam training until I got to Vietnam.
Really?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I know I train fired on the M16 before I left SEAL. But there wasn't anything that I remember until I hit Vietnam. The CAV had a kind of a little training program that they put us through once we got there. You know, but there wasn't anything. I'm sure there were in places like Fort Polk at Tigerland and stuff like that, but you know, the place there at SEAL where I was at, the training I got was, you know, in calling in artillery and various things like that. I got training in codes. I got training in radio procedures and stuff like that. In fact, the irony of the whole thing was kind of like, because of some of this training that I got is where I ended up once I got to 11th Cav, because like I said, my orders read howitzer battery, you know, and everything. So once I get to Vietnam, you know, well, I report. And one of the things I did want to tell you was while I was still home on leave before I went to Vietnam, like I said, I hadn't heard anything about the 11th Army Cav. And I'd still like to find it because I think it came out in June, sometime while I was home on leave. The Life magazine had this 2 or 3 page article, and what it was about this K troop of the 11th Armored Cav getting in this big fight and getting the shit kicked out of them, you know, and everything. But they had all these pictures and stuff of the 11th Cav in Vietnam, and my mother freaked.
Really?
And I thought, wow, cool, you know, a combat unit, you know, guys that are really doing something, you know. But of course it didn't dawn on me that what they were actually reporting was this K troop getting messed up pretty bad, you know. So I get to Vietnam, and you know, the same thing that you hear all the guys talk about. I mean, you step off an air-conditioned plane, it's like walking into a blast furnace, you know, and the smells assailed your nose. And in fact, I heard it all on TV last night. I don't know whether you saw that thing on Channel 5 about Vietnam. They had a program, about an hour program, that Vietnam vets were talking about their service in Vietnam. There was about 12 or 13 of them, you know, that told a pretty good thing. In fact, I was thinking about that and thinking, well, you know, that's what you hear all the time, the smells, the heat, the wire over the windows of the buses, you know. But all of that I experienced and everything. But kind of a different twist on mine was my family doctor that I had grown up with was in the reserve and was a major or a lieutenant colonel, I can't remember which, and he went back in, and he was in Vietnam. Well, my mother wrote him that I was coming to Vietnam. So I'm at 90th Replacement, which is right there in the Long Bend complex and outside of Saigon in that area, waiting to ship on to the 11th Cav or whatever. And they have these loudspeakers that they call various people, you know. Well, this loudspeaker comes on, Corporal James Holt, would you report to the front office or whatever they called it, or, you know, to the front of the 90th Replacement or whatever. And I go up there and walk in, and this sergeant or whatever says, there's a lieutenant colonel out front with a jeep that wants to see you. He's asking for you specifically. And of course, he was puzzled.
Right.
You know, well, I walk out and it's Dr. Slade. You know, and I, like I say, I grew up with this man, was my family doctor and everything. Well, so I got a little different twist on the fact that he essentially got me cleared to go with him. And he took me around Saigon and showed me stuff and took me to a real nice restaurant in downtown Saigon. And we ate and talked and this and that and the other before he brought me back. That afternoon, he takes me by his compound, showed me where he worked there at 2nd Field Force. And he was in charge of, like, communicable diseases there the area. And of course, that's something that my mother had done, and he had done a lot too. He was our boss too, back at home before he went back to the service school. He gave me this box, this big cardboard box, and showed me what was in it. And what it was these 5-gallon waterproof canvas buckets with a rope on one end and a shower head on the other. And there were, like, I think 20 of them in this box. And he said, I'm going to ship this to you at Black Horse Base Camp. And he said, I will mail it to you, because if I mail it to you, nobody can mess with it. You know, it'll have to come to you. He said, now when you get this, you get one of these shower buckets to your captain, one to your first sergeant, you have one to, you know, your mess sergeant or whatever, and keep one for yourself, or, you know, several of them for yourself, and give the rest of them to your supply sergeant to do with as he wants to. And he said, these things are like gold, you know, and everything. And he said, this will get you in good with all your all your people. And I thought, well, that's cool, you know. And he did that, and I did that, and it did, you know. It was really neat. But we had those things scattered around and everything. But I got to spend some time, actually, instead of like a normal guy going through the 90th replacement, just sitting around pulling shit details till they flew you out to your unit. Well, I actually got to go with him and spend, you know, nearly half a day just driving around with him in a Jeep, and he showed me Saigon, and so I got to see some stuff. Unfortunately, at that time, I didn't have a camera, so, you know, I wished I'd had a camera so I could have gotten photographs of all that and stuff. But anyway, I stayed at 90th Replacement for a day or two there, I think. Two or three days, something like that, and they flew me in this caribou to Black Horse Base Camp, which really wasn't that far away, you know, and everything. And I don't know, it was just one of those things. I was just kind of going with the flow, and we got to the base camp, and of course everybody's supposed to check in at regimental headquarters. Well, the day that I came in, there was about 15 or 20 of us, and I think, you know, nearly all those guys went to K-Troop to replace these guys that were wounded and killed and stuff in this thing. And I went to Howe Battery, and at the time the unit was out and everything, but I did get some. You know, they took all us new guys over to this area, and we sat in bleachers, and then they took us through and showed us booby traps and punji stakes and all that stuff. But that was really about all the actual Vietnam training I got. It was just kind of like almost a one-day indoctrination thing. There wasn't anything really where they taught you escape and invasion or anything, you know, a bunch of anything. And I think I hung around there in the rear area for a day or two, and then they put me on a helicopter and flew me out to Howe Battery. It was, you know, kind of one of those things that, you know, our base camp was really pretty neat. And they still had, and I'm trying to remember this because Hal was out in the field, but there was one gun or something that was back. It was either back for repairs or something, and everything, because where our hooch area was there at base camp, they had, we were at like at a corner of the base camp, because they had areas for the guns to set up when they came back in or whatever. And I'll never forget the first night I was, some of these guys that were in this Howe Battery area were all, I think, guys fixing to leave, and they were already back and they'd been there. See, I didn't connect until later on that I was in like the first group of people for the Cav, 11th Cav, that was coming in as replacements. Mm-hmm. These guys came over in like July, August of 66. That's when they arrived in country, and they came in boats. And then we were coming in then as replacements, and Iro arrived over there sometime right at the 1st of July there sometime. I think it was after the 4th, but it was right in there someplace between the 4th and the 10th of July.
Of 67.
Yeah, and these guys were fixing, starting to rotate out. Mm. And so these guys that were there at the base camp were guys that had already served their year and everything. Of course, they're telling all these stories and filling my head full of all this stuff, you know, and everything. And I'm listening to them, you know, and everything. But I realize now what's happening. But at the time, I didn't know the hydraulics on these 155 howitzers that they have with 11 cab. We had self-propelled howitzers and how battery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this one gun was set up, and I guess it was going to fire some H&Is or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they heard the hydraulics as the gun tube raised and all this stuff. And, of course, it was across the road and in an open area from where these hooches are.
Mm-hmm.
But all these guys were watching me. And that gun went off, and I like to tore a hole in that tent. I mean, just, you know, because this big boom and everything. I didn't know. I heard the hydraulics. I know I heard them, but, it, you know, it didn't compute.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knew what it was. I didn't. You know, they did. They knew what was fixing to happen. This gun goes off, and I like to piss myself and tore everything up, jumping I don't know where.
Uh-huh.
I think I tore outside to jump in this bunker that they had. And these guys are laughing and rolling on the floor and everything. And that was kind of my indoctrination to the guns. And that was just one gun firing, you know, instead of all six.
Yeah.
But it's funny how sounds, how you get involved in sounds over there. Because, you know, after a while, once you got used to that stuff, you could be sleeping out in the field, in your track. Of course, the top hatch would be open or the back ramp would be down. Those guns could be 50 feet away, and they'd be firing off and on H&Is, and that was harassment and interdiction fire, where they just fired at trail junctions and stream crossings and places where there might be somebody. It was just kind of keeping Charlie on his toes, you know, might be somebody coming down this trail, we'll put a few rounds in there just to see type of stuff. But those guns could fire all night long and you could sleep.
Mm.
500 meters out, pump, 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 and you'd be up, raising the back ramp, closing the top hatch, getting everything going because there's incoming mortars.
Mm.
And you learn to recognize those sounds. You know, we could sleep, we were on. And I guess I'll tell you how I ended up there. When I first got to Howe Battery, the captain was this captain named Captain Love, and he was from Dallas, Texas. I've never been able to locate this guy again, but I remember that he was, I'm almost positive it was Dallas. He was from up around Dallas or something. But he liked me, or thought he'd take care of me because I was an East Texas boy, you know, close. He knew where Longview was and this and that and the other. And they were going to assign me actually to the fire direction control because that's the training I'd had. I wasn't a gun bunny that fired the guns, but I had learned in AIT how to plot all the stuff to fire the artillery and fire direction control, and they were going to put me in there. Well, he thought he'd do me a favor, and he was going to make me his driver. Well, I thought for a while, well, that might be cool, and then the more I got to thinking about it, the more I got to thinking, I'm going to be riding with this guy in this Jeep with these two antennas on it, and anybody that sees us knows that he's an officer, and they're going to be shooting at this Jeep.
Yeah.
And I decided, whoa, wait a minute. King's X I don't want to do this, you know. And anyway, I tried to talk him out of it. Of course, the deal was is I was going to drive the Jeep to where we were going, and then, of course, I was going to work in fire direction control. You know, and it would have been okay if I'd have been in fire direction control, but driving his Jeep was not what I wanted to do. So I just started screwing up. And every time there was a buffalo wallow that I could see that we were driving, I'd drive the Jeep in it and get it stuck or, you know, or do something or hit a puddle and splash water all over him or something like that. It was nothing, you know. I just jacked with him all the time, you know, and stuff. And he finally got fed up with it. And I had been in the unit long enough to figure out that they had what they called FO tracks. These were all guys that were in HAL battery, they were attached to HAL battery, but first squadron we had three FO tracks, and it was 901, 902, and 903 track, and each track had four guys on it, and they were kind of all pretty much like me. They knew codes, they knew radio procedure and everything like that, but they operate with the line troops, the actual troops that went out different places. Because what would happen in a tactical situation in the field was we'd go to some area to work. Well, they set up a big logger position and set up the guns there. But then these line troops would go out into other areas and patrol and look for Charlie and try to get into shit, you know. And then the guns were there to fire artillery support and everything. Well, I wanted to be where the action was, you know. So I kept jacking with Captain Love until he finally put me on one of the FO tracks. And because I told him that's where I want to be, and the FO tracks were... See, they threatened people with the FO tracks and HAL battery, because a lot of these guys would prefer to be back at the guns or back in fire direction control because they're in a safer area.
Right.
You know, but I don't know. It's just the way I was. I wanted to be out, you know, doing something. So I finally got put on the FO tracks, and that's where I spent the rest of my time in Vietnam, on these FO tracks. And essentially what we did was we were just a regular line track unless there was a dismounted patrol. And if there was a dismounted patrol, like lots of times we'd be working with 1st Infantry Division or the 25th or 101st Airborne, we might be in their area, or we might be working with some Arvin units or stuff like that. But anybody that was sending out a patrol, one of the 12 of us went on that patrol. And so we were like forward observers, but we were also, my job on the track, I was left machine gunner, you know, and that's what I started off on, is left machine gunner. But if there was a dismount, and depending on who was working the area, you know, because I might be in 902 track and we might be with A troop. 903 track would be over here with D company, the tank company, and they might be someplace else, you know, in the same general area, but not close together, you know. So it just depends and everything. So it was kind of one of those things. I was a machine gunner when we were moving, or if we were busting jungle, I was just another machine gunner on the track. But if we got someplace and decided to send out an ambush patrol that night, or we were working with the 1st Infantry and they had a patrol that was going to go out and work something or something like that, well, one of us would go out on that patrol, because if the shit hit the fan, we were the ones that called in the artillery and stuff like that. And so essentially what you had is you had some lieutenants around, but we didn't ever have enough lieutenants to go around. And usually by the time they had operated with us for a while, they'd call them and put them doing something else. So we were really forward observers, you know, and essentially that's what I did for the rest of the time that I was over there. And like I told people, I did recon missions, but it wasn't like I was walking point, you know. They pretty well, anybody we worked with, they protected us, because if the shit hit the fan, we had the radio, we could call back, we knew the codes, we knew the frequencies and everything, we carried the code book. You know, my job was to destroy that code book if it looked like we were going to get, you know, overrun or something like that. I had to destroy that code book, you know, and everything, but it wasn't like I was walking point or anything like that. They usually put us in the middle of any patrol we were at and stuff. And I didn't do a whole lot of dismounts because, you know, most of our stuff was done operating off the tracks. But, you know, occasionally from time to time. And I was lucky enough that I got to work with a lot of the different units we worked with. We worked with the Australians. I got to spend some time with the Aussies.
How was that?
They're nuts. Absolutely. They're nuts. The guys be drinking beer and having a firefight, you know. They just, you know, nothing seemed to bother them, you know. Just absolutely, you know. We've been getting shot at, and we're ducking, and this and that and the other, and they're spanning around going, I think he's firing over here. You know? They're nuts. But great guys, you know. Fun to be around, and you know they had their beer ration out in the field and stuff. Not to say that we didn't from time to time, but you know they got it, and had it, and everything like that. Good soldiers, stuff. We worked with the Koreans. Now they were exceptional as far as fighting. You know. Very highly disciplined to the point of, you know, had great fear of their sergeants and their officers and stuff like that. I mean, they ruled by fear, you know, and everything. Kind of felt sorry for them, you know, and stuff like that, because it was nothing for one of their sergeants or their officers to just slap the shit out of one of these, you know, troops or whatever, and they expected it, you know. That was the way they disciplined them and everything like that. But got to work with them. Got to work with the Special Forces one time. We went up, I can't remember the route, but we called it the Bamboo Highway, and they had spotted the Special Forces. I think it was the Bogot Special Forces camp. It was up at the edge of the Central Highlands. But they had spotted some Russian tanks across the border and some tracks over on our side of the border. So we took the whole first squadron up this road that no vehicles had been up since the French pulled out. And it was overgrown with bamboo. That's why we called it the Bamboo Highway, because it's just grown over and everything and stuff. But our lead elements were pushing burned out hulks of French tanks off the road, where they'd evidently ambushed this French column and just essentially annihilated them or whatever and everything. But we got up there and worked with the Special Forces for about 3 or 4 weeks, hoping that we could, you know, lure these Russian tanks to come across and fight us, but they never would. You know, we never could. Everything, but they had spotted a road that they had built up there too, under triple canopy. You couldn't even see it from the air, and everything. But that made me decide that I was glad that I didn't get with the Special Forces, because these guys were hung out up there at the end of no place. You know, they were just amazed at our howitzers and the firepower that we had and all that stuff, you know, and this camp they were in, you know, they had I think a couple of 50s and 60s and stuff, and that was about the extent of their their firepower. And of course, by that time I was so used to, like I said, my track alone, we had a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on the top and center and two 60s off the back, and we had 10,000 rounds per machine gun on my track.
Right.
Plus a case of grenades, plus an M79, several cases of grenades for that, our own personal weapons, all sorts of clips for that. For a while, we had captured a little 60 millimeter mortar that Charlie had got someplace. It was a U.S. Mm-hmm. mortar, but he had it, and we liberated it, and we had that on our track for a while. Hmm. Played with it until they came and took it away from us. They didn't want us because there was no base plate for it, so we were just putting the bottom of it in a helmet steel pot and firing it by hand, you know, just one of those things.
Did you ever use it in combat?
No, we're just jacking with it. Half the time, that's the thing that was bad about mortars over there is these charges they had for the things and everything that get damp. Mm. And sometimes they wouldn't go off. Our four deuce guys had the same problem. I didn't see it, but I heard about in base camp one night they had the four deuce guys in and they were firing some H&Is and everything. There's some guys in another part of the camp playing cards in this hooch, and the charge didn't go off right on this four deuce, and it comes in, comes down through the tent, and embeds itself in this footlocker that these guys are using to play cards on. And of course, they all unasked the tent, and these four deuce guys come running over, going, "Has anybody seen our mortar rim?" And they drug it out of the footlocker and took it back and refired it. You know, and stupid, but you know that was. Some of these guys are real idiots, you know. Yeah.
Did you ever have any problem with M16 ammo getting damp?
No. Like I said, there again, different totally from the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had these big 40 millimeter boxes that the helicopters, and so Glenn Cav had his own helicopter unit too, so we could access this stuff. And the way our track was set up inside, we had these 40 millimeter cans in a U-shape inside the track.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people that know APCs know that there's seats in there. But what the cab did is they tore all that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even have the seat that slid up and down for the track commander. They took all of that stuff out. Because they had learned certain things over there. If you were standing in that cupola on top and the track hit a mine, that cupola would blow off the top of the track if it was a big enough mine. If you're standing up inside that cupola and standing down in the track, it would cut you half in two. So the track commanders finally got where they would put them aboard up there inside the cupola and sit cross-legged up in the cupola.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hit a mine and it blew off, you went with the cupola.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could un-ass it in the air or even land in it and still not be as messed up as if you're standing half in and half out.
Right.
And we as machine gunners rode on the back patch.
Mm-hmm.
If we were moving, especially if we were moving down a road or something like that, because if you hit a mine, it'd blow you off the track, but most of the blowing would go inside.
Mm-hmm.
And we lined the floor with 3/4 plywood, or they may have even had some of this engineer planking stuff that they used, you know, that was steel.
Mm-hmm.
They put that in the bottom and put sandbags over the top of it, and then put these cans down and everything, but we could sleep four people inside that track dry, you know, because one across the back under the 50, two down the sides, one man in the middle of the U on the floor on this plywood, and we've even, in desperate situations, have hung a hammock in the middle and slept a fifth guy in there, but it gets pretty tight, you know. But essentially, with these cans, they were waterproof if they were sealed. So we had cans that were loaded full of 16 clips, and then other cans that were personal gear and all this stuff, and then of course the ammo for the machine guns that was belted together already and ready to go and stuff. So all of this stuff stayed pretty well dry and out of the weather and everything, as long as it was sealed inside that can. So we didn't have near the problems with our weaponry as the infantry does. And like I said, if you were out, you know, you cleaned your weapon. We were pretty, that was one of the things that we did pretty religiously, you know. If we stopped anywhere, you checked your 60, you made sure, you know, that there wasn't anything clogging up on it or anything anywhere, the dust, you'd wipe it off, get it off and stuff. And of course, we had diesel with us because that's what the tracks ran on. We could clean weapons with diesel, you know, real easy. You know, we were able to carry and access a lot of stuff that the infantrymen in the jungle didn't have a chance to. You know, and so it was a whole lot easier in a lot of ways for us than it was your run-of-the-mill grunts, you know. So, no, I never had a misfire on my weapon.
What did you think of the 16?
I don't know that I thought of it much because, quite frankly, most of the time that I dismounted, I carried the 60.
Oh.
Because I love the M60, you know, and I was a big enough guy that I could carry it, you know, and I liked it, and given the opportunity, if we were doing a dismount and I could take it, if they'd let me take it, I'd take the 60.
Would you be carrying a radio too?
No, usually one of the other guys would carry the radio. Our job was to have the radio there,
okay.
You know. They'd have the RTO for whoever was running the patrol or whatever, carrying the, I think, usually it's a Crick 25, you know, which wasn't the greatest radio in the world, but if we could get back to one of the tracks. And see, my track was considered a command track because we had four radios on my track, an FM and then three others, you know. And so we monitored the squadron net, the company or troop net that we were with, you know, usually had another radio set on anybody else that we might be working with. And then, of course, that FM was set up where we could access the planes or the helicopters or anything like that. So, you know, and sometimes we had to have to switch them off, you know, depending on what was doing, but my track had access to all that and everything, whereas the other tracks wouldn't, you know. They'd just usually be on the troop net, you know, and could switch back and forth between that and the other. But we were considered a command track sort of thing in that aspect, because we had those radios in there in case we needed them.
Okay.
You know, if things got to going, you know, then we could, from one of the FO tracks, we could call the helicopters, we could call the jets, we could call, you know, contact the various stuff.
Okay, so you would be directly dealing with air support then?
We did if we were ordered to. You know, there again, it depends on if you were out with you know, one of the troops. And a lot of times it depends on what the troop commander wanted you to do. he would say, okay, 902 track, you get in touch with these guys and you bring them in. In the meantime, I'm going to do this, you know, and he might be working with talking to somebody else. Or sometimes he did it and all we did was listen in, you know, so we'd know what was going on. That was the one thing about our track. The FO tracks, we always knew what was going on because we could hear it all, you know, whereas a lot of the other tracks, they wouldn't know sometimes, you know, exactly what was going on. And plus, see, if we were, many times they put the FO track, you know, back at the logger, even though we still weren't working with the guns, if we were going to be in like what they called a squadron logger and going to be there for a while, lots of times we'd rotate the three tracks going out, and a couple of them would be out and one would be back at the squadron logger, and they would be rotating us into the top. And we worked in the talk as the radio operators in the talk.
Right.
You know, so that was another one of our duties, you know, was to be in the talk and working a 24-hour shift working radios. So that was another sort of thing that we did besides going out on with the troops and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed when we stayed back and worked the talk, because then you always knew what was going on. Because those radios, if you're a squadron, then you've got, you know what D Company's doing over here, you know what A, B, and C troops are doing.
Right.
You know, you've got a feel for the whole thing that's going on, because you're sitting there and you're working with the colonel, you know, and the S2 and all those guys, you know, so you're really up on what everybody's doing. And that was always pretty neat, you know, because that way you had pretty good knowledge of what was going on at any given time, you know, and stuff like that. So I enjoyed that probably as much as, almost as much as being out with the troops, you know, and everything. But, you know, like I said, I didn't really spend time with the guns, you know, and everything. The guys that I know that I see at reunions now, I really don't know as many of the How Battery guys as I do guys from A, B, and C and D Company, you know, the troops, because they were the ones I was out with most of the time working with and stuff like that. So it was kind of one of those things that was a little bit different type of deal. I knew a few of the guys with the guns, but you know, you weren't around them much, you know, other than they were set up over here, you know, and you'd see them and stuff like that, but you're really working more with all these other guys and stuff, because at any given time, I spent a lot of time with B Troop, seemed like that was the one I probably spent the most time with over there. And everything, and have a lot of real good friends. I got a friend up in Louisville now that he and I always usually stay together at the reunions if his wife didn't come, because he and I, you know, hung out a lot in B Troop. He was one of the drivers in B Troop and everything. But it was an exciting year in that I went through the first Tet Offensive. I guess that was probably the big event for me over there. We were set up, I think we were in Hobo. I know we were up in Warzone City. But I think we were in Hobo Woods up there. And we've been reporting for a while that we were not hitting or seeing the contact that we normally got when we went up there. Nearly the whole time that I worked with 11th Cav, we worked Warzone DNC, Cambodian border area. Okay. We were kind of a blocking force between the Cambodian border and Saigon, Long Bend.
basically west of Saigon.
Yeah, that's what we did most of the time, was work those areas. Mm-hmm. They were free fire zones for the first point, so we didn't have to worry about civilians a whole lot. It was an infiltration route. That's where we seemed to get the most contact, and of course, that was our job. I left my base camp, and it was supposed to be a 3-day mission, and I didn't go back to the base camp for over 6 months.
Wow.
It was just one little thing after another, and then Ted happened. The day that Ted happened, and it was daytime for us, we'd gone out and done a search and destroy in S&D that morning, and had come back to the lobber position, and sitting on top of the track, eating C's, and the radio came on, and it was essentially the colonel, and he was going, move out, all units move out, Saigon's getting hit, Second Field's getting hit, Way's getting hit, all the compounds across the country are getting hit, we've been ordered to Second Field Force, move out, move out, move out. And essentially, we had a lieutenant on the track at that time, and we didn't have a lieutenant much, but like I said earlier, sometimes they get a new lieutenant in, they put him on the FO track for a while, and if he did okay there, then they jerk him off and put him someplace else. Mm-hmm. You know, so we trained a few of the lieutenants, and this was a pretty good lieutenant. In fact, I'd like to find him too. His name was Lieutenant Chiamato, and he was off the block in New York someplace. Mm-hmm. You know, neat guy, Italian, you know, just neat fella. And anyway, we had liberated, I think, from one of the first infantry units that we'd worked with. We liberated this little small tent. Mm-hmm. And we had fixed this tent for him to sleep in, you know, because it was hard for all of us. So we liked him, so we fixed him this tent. We'd set it up for him at night and everything. It's a fairly new tent, and we didn't have time to take it down. We essentially took a machete and chopped it to pieces.
Hmm.
And everything, and was throwing gear, you know, on the track and everything, and getting fired up. And it probably didn't take 15 minutes, and we were rolling. And Charlie evidently knew where we were and where we'd probably go, because they had us mined in.
Hmm.
And we started coming out, and we started hitting mines, and we'd move and try to go another way and hit another. And it wasn't doing anything, but, you know, a lot of them were fairly small, you know, but a couple of, I think we lost two tracks and one tank through a tread, and the colonel essentially said, get all the personal gear, get the weapons, the codes and everything, drop thermite grenades in them and leave them. I mean, that's how critical our wow. move order was and everything. And we came out of Hobo and stopped in the middle of the afternoon at Lockay, which was the 1st Infantry Division base camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we pulled in there, and the colonel essentially said, all wheeled vehicles are staying here. And all the track vehicles, and he kind of got gathered up in the middle of everybody and just told us what was going on. You know, he said, everything is getting hit. This is a big offensive. We're going in, you know, right down the highway in through Saigon into 2nd Field Force, and you know, there's little compounds, American compounds, or actually Vietnamese compounds that had advisors that have been overrun.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see an American, load him on your track, but keep moving, you know. And the thing I'll never forget is coming out of Lock Hay, you hit a ridge and you kind of go down in the valley, and we hit that ridge and it was like dusk. It was just still some, you know, the sun had gone down, but there was still sun set in the sky and everything. But everywhere you looked, there were helicopters.
Really?
I mean, it looked like every chopper in Vietnam was in the air, and there was all these fire going on, you know, from these choppers down at various places and stuff. And we were like, my track was like in the middle of this column.
Mm.
I mean, and all I could see in front of me was tanks and tracks, and all I could see behind me was tanks and tracks. The whole squadron. And we moved, I think they said, I've got it written down in a magazine someplace, but I think it was like we moved 96 miles in from essentially 12 noon to before midnight.
Wow.
Moved the entire squadron out of Hobo Woods and pulled into Second Field. But they knew we were coming because they pushed burning log trucks out in front of, in the middle of the road, set them on fire. And our lead tanks and stuff, we had like some of the tanks had Rome plow blades on the front of them. And they just pushed this stuff out of the way and we kept going. And went right through the middle of Saigon. By the time we got in close, they were saying that there might be groups of civilians that the VC had taken prisoner and they'd push them out in front of them, you know, or whatever. And we were told to be careful, you know, with what we shot at and everything, make sure that it was the enemy before we shot at anybody or stuff like that. But we were essentially told, return fire and continue to move, you know, no matter what happens. Because normally our deal was if we got shot at, we broke down and attacked, you know. But this time we were told, no, just return fire and continue to move, you know. And we got into Second Field Force, and it was the neatest thing. Because like I say, it was like the middle of the night, and you could step off my track onto a bunker, onto another track, onto a tank, onto another bunker. You could probably walk all the way around their compound without ever getting on the ground.
Wow.
Because we had everything there, and we just hit the perimeter. Because, see, they'd attack Second Field Force. They'd attack the main gate from this widow's village across the road. And, you know, it's the middle of the morning, and these idiots in there at Second Field, you know, you're talking guys that were clerks and typists, and
right.
Nothing had ever happened there. I mean, they got a few mortars occasionally, maybe a rocket once in a while, you know, but it's all, you know, you're talking a four-lane highway out in front of the main gate.
Right.
And everything. Well, they didn't notice that there weren't any villagers or kids in this widow's village. This village across the road was a village for the widows and children of South Vietnamese soldiers that had been killed. These guys that were pulling guard on the gate didn't notice that there weren't any women or children walking around that morning. They didn't catch it. And all of a sudden they looked up and here comes a battalion of NVA across the road at them. You know, well, they got them stopped, and actually they say it was an MP compound down the road that this E5 sergeant figured out what was going on, and he loaded up three Jeeps with 60s mounted on pedestals on the back, and they ran the road like three times in front of Second Field, and they said after the first pass, there was no rubber on the tires of the Jeeps. They were running them on rims.
Wow.
And they essentially kept these NVA pinned down across the road till they got the gates closed and got more people on the perimeter, you know, and got it stopped. And every one of these, you know, guys in the Jeeps were all wounded. I think they gave the sergeant like the Distinguished Service Cross, and all the other guys got Silver Stars or something, you know. But we got there that night, and it was, there wasn't anything going on by the time we got there. But they had been attacking from the back, and everything and stuff. So we're all just kind of standing around on top of our tracks looking. And the thing I remember most is we'd never seen a cobra. They had them in country, but they'd been test flying. They hadn't been firing them. And we're on the back perimeter, was where my track ended up. And we're standing there on top of the track, just kind of looking around, thinking, this is cool, you know, there's nothing going on here, you know. And all of a sudden, this heavy team of cobras come in, and this first one's pumping out those 40 millimeters out the front, and that was the first time we'd seen that, and that was pretty cool. And then that second one comes in and cuts loose with a minigun, and that scared the crap out of everybody. And then the last one comes in and is firing rockets. And of course, we'd seen the rockets before, but that minigun was something else, you know, and we're watching all of this. Well, the way things are set up there, like I say, this is Second Field Force perimeter. Mm-hmm. Here's the road running down in front of it. Well, the road kind of curves around over this way.
Right.
Well, over here is 90th replacement. Well, out here is open field rice paddies, but their back perimeter kind of looks out this way, and second field looks out this way. Well, what Charlie had done is they'd done kind of just a attempt to hit the back perimeter, but out here in these rice paddies and weeds and everything, they'd left some snipers. Well, these guys would pop up and they'd shoot over here at these guys and shoot over here at these guys, and they were having a firefight with each other. You know, shooting at their own guys. So we told them to get off the guns, that we were there now and we'd take care of the place, you know, and everything, because we figured out real quick, you know, because we knew Charlie didn't have a 60, you know, and these guys are opening up over here on their own, you know, shooting at each other. And luckily, you know, weren't doing a real good job of it. And so we stopped that and everything. Then somebody had been scouting around, and they come back and they go, there's a swimming pool up here. So we all grabbed bars of soap and went to this swimming pool and took a bath. They had to drain the thing the next day. They said there was about 6 inches of scum on the water, you know, and everything. But we'd never seen a swimming pool, and they had flush toilets, you know, and all this stuff. And we were just amazed, you know, and we thought it was great. But eventually we stayed anyway at Second Field for a while until things died down. And then they sent us to Cholon, which was the Chinese section of Saigon.
Right.
And that's where all the VC had finally holed up and had kind of been pushed to after everything had settled down around the area. And we did a lot of stuff down there, mostly just were set up on the banks of the river and were interdicting river traffic at night and doing patrols through the Cholon section, just looking for pockets of VC during the day and gradually rooting them out and everything. But we all thought it was cool duty, you know, because it wasn't anything like fighting in the jungle or stuff, and it wasn't near as intense. There wasn't any mines or anything like that or booby traps, so we thought it was pretty neat. But that was, I guess, my big event over there as far as, you know, really being involved in something, you know, pretty big and everything. But I'm supposedly able to wear 4 stars on my campaign ribbon, because everything that happened, you know, I arrived in Vietnam, there was a campaign going on, and that one got over and another campaign started. Then there were 2 real close together. The Tet was one, and then the post-Tet. And then right before I left, there was another campaign. So where a lot of guys might have only been over there a year and got like two stars, well, I ended up with 4 because of Tet and post-Tet campaigns or whatever. But that was the biggie for me. Oh, let's see. I got wounded on my 21st birthday in September, and that goes back to I'd just gotten on the FO tracks, and we were supposed to be checking out an old base camp that we knew was there, and all the guys on the track except me were old timers and fixing to leave. So when they asked for a volunteer to dismount, I said, I'll dismount because, you know, you guys are fixing to go home.
Right.
And everything. Well, you know, we just dismounted guys off a lot of the tracks is all we were doing. We weren't working with anybody. And we was going to go down and check out this base camp. And we took off down this trail. And like I said, I remembered what I'd been told in basic. And, you know, these guys had been in this base camp area two or three times in the past, you know, and they thought, I guess, it was a field day, and they were clumped up and everything, and I just backed off from the group. In fact, a couple of guys behind me were trying to get me to tighten it up, you know, and I backed off about, I don't know, about 10, 12 yards from the guys in front of me. Well, what we found out later is they took a fruitcake tin that some GI had thrown away, and they filled it full of nails and little links of chain and ball bearings and nuts and bolts and just all kinds of stuff that they picked up, coated it with plaster and put a shake charge behind it, and they set it up. And there was a curve in the trail, and they actually let the point man and this lieutenant walk past the curve in the trail, and they popped this thing. It was command detonated. They set it off and hauled ass. And I was the last one in line wounded, and it didn't knock me down. And suddenly everybody in front of me is down. And it just scared the crap out of me, and I started firing over the top of these guys that was down. And I'll never forget this A Troop first sergeant at that time was this big old British guy. And I never knew his story, but he spoke with a British accent and everything. And he'd been around, everybody said, since God was in Pampers. You know, I guess he joined the American Army and just stayed. But he came down and grabbed me by the shoulder and wanted to know what I was shooting at. And I said, anything that moves, Top. And he said, well, that was command detonated. There's nobody there. Let's go help these guys. Well, when I knelt down to the guy in front of me, they figured out later a length of chain about 6 inches long had taken his arm off right above the elbow.
Jeez.
So he's laying there and he's bleeding. So I knew enough first aid, and I was going to try to get a hold of that main vein in his arm and pinch it off until the medics got there. Well, as I knelt down, I noticed I had a piece of blood on the inside of my leg. And I said, I must have been hit. You know, I didn't feel a thing. So I knelt on down and got that vein and was holding that and trying to keep him from bleeding to death. Well, the medics got to us pretty quick. We had good medics. And this medic got in and got a hemostat on that vein on that guy and was working on him. And he said, are you hit? And I said, yeah, I think I may be. Well, I didn't know what I looked like. And I had this guy's blood all over me, you know. So this medic thought I was in shock and was blown up. So he's ripping my clothes off. Well, we get in and I've got a little hole right here on the inside of my leg, and another one he checked up in here, and it was beside my groin. And of course I was the slightest wounded of everybody and everything, and I put my flak vest on that day, and I had metal embedded in the chest of that flak vest.
Wow.
You know, and didn't even really notice it until, you know, so in fact, somebody brought it and showed it to me in the hospital. You know, after I was already there, they airlifted. But there was 12 wounded, and one killed, and one died later that day. And out of the 12 of us wounded, 9 came back to the States with arms, legs, and eyes missing, and I had 2 ball bearings.
Hmm.
In fact, I didn't, you know, it wasn't even bad stuff. I got a ball bearing, and it's embedded in this bone, and the other's in my pelvis.
Hmm.
And they left them both in because they said, we'd have to cut you wide open to get them out, and, you know, they're not hurting anything.
Hmm.
You know, they're half embedded in the bone, and the bone will grow over them. So, you know, I was lucky there. But that was my 21st birthday.
Hmm.
And I'll never forget that because I remembered what my DI had said. And I put that flak vest on, and I never wore it on the dismount again. They're too hot and too heavy.
Hmm.
But for some reason, that day, I put it on.
Hmm.
You know, and I don't know what made me do it. I guess it's because of my first dismount, and I was a little nervous about it. And But that was the first time I was wounded, and then I was wounded again in May, and we tied into a big battle, and this was after Tet and everything, and we got back up into the war zone C.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't realize that we pretty much decimated the VC.
Mm-hmm.
During Tet.
Yeah.
So after Tet was when we really started tying into the NVA units,
mm-hmm.
you know, and stuff like that. And one of our line troops was out one morning, and I was still in the logger, and they were patrolling through an area that we patrolled through, and the 1st Infantry Division had patrolled through, and they ran into this NVA battalion, and these guys had come out of a complex that we didn't even know was there.
Wow.
They were massing on the ground to move someplace, and
mm.
this line troop surprised them, and they decided to fight.
Mm.
And that day, we fought those guys 8 hours, and eventually found out that it wasn't just one battalion, it was 2.
Wow.
And they had a quarter mile bunker line at the edge of this rubber, and about a quarter to a half mile back, this complex. And when we finally got it busted and some of the tunnel rats and stuff went in, they had complexes underground for 150 men to sleep.
Wow.
And stuff. It was a staging area and probably been there 10, 15 years, you know. They probably had it when they were fighting the French, because they had hospitals and all sorts of shit. And we just happened to catch them on top of the ground.
Hmm.
But the thing that was tough was this front bunker line was set up with concrete and stuff. It was just like pillboxes, you know, with firing slits and the whole deal. But all this stuff was connected, and we would push past the front line into the rubber, and then they were coming out of holes and stuff all around us. And stuff, and by that time I had progressed to the point where I was track commander of 9 or 2 track, and it was real hairy, because, you know, we're firing, and what we're seeing in front of us, or some guy jumps up over here and is attacking a track,
mm-hmm.
and you shoot at him to keep him off your buddy, and some guy jumps up over here and throws a chock on at you.
Mm.
So you're slapping that down with one hand and firing the machine gun with the other.
Wow.
And everybody on my track got wounded that day by either shrapnel or something. But what hit me right here on top of this leg, I was sitting up in there like I was telling you, cross-legged.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured it out later. You got that cupola around you.
Mm-hmm.
You got the 50 sitting there, then the 50 sitting in a shield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you move that thing, you know, the whole thing moves, and the shield moves with it. Well, the only place that AK round could have come was the little slits right where that 50 sits mm-hmm. in that shield.
Yeah.
And that AK round came probably down the right side of the machine gun,
mm-hmm.
hit over here inside the cupola, and ricocheted into my leg. Well, and I remember I said the first time I was wounded, I didn't feel a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't hurt till the next day. Racked. You know, I never felt it. That sucker felt like Mickey Mantle took a full swing with a baseball bat, and I thought my leg was blown off. I'm screaming, cussing, you know, dropped down in the track, you know, screaming bloody murder, you know, God, I'm hit, my leg's blown off, you know, my whole 9 yards. The driver crawls out of his thing there and rips my leg open, and here's this AK round laying flattened out, half in, half out of my leg, just laying there. And my driver goes, wow. You ain't hurt. Put a bandage on that shit and get on the 50. You know, and that's essentially what we did, you know.
Wow.
But that sucker, and it's because it hit right into that muscle, mm-hmm. you know. And, of course, I had my leg, and you're tense, and the adrenaline's flowing and everything. And I thought I was dead, you know. But that was my second wound and everything. And I was going to stay another six months, and had already signed most of the papers except for my final signature, and I kept thinking about it, and I told the colonel, I said, I don't think I'm going to stay in 6 months. I said, third time may be charm with them, too, and I'm going to get on out of here, you know, because they've got me twice now. And that kind of scared me that day, because that was the hairiest thing that, you know, most of the time with us, they hit us and we attacked them back and they ran away. Mm. You know, that was the Charlie or the NVA, either one, didn't really want to jack with 11th Cal because we had too much firepower. Mm. You know, we could flat mess them up big time. They'd mine us, they'd, you know, try to set off some sort of booby traps, you know, or stuff like that. But as far as fighting us head on, they didn't do it, you know. I didn't. That was the main one that I remember, you know, that we really tied into them, and they fought, you know, nearly all. That was the first time we had to get resupplied with ammo.
Wow.
And that'll give you an idea. Mm. We ran through our basic load and had to pull back, and it wasn't 8 hours solid. It was, you know, we'd hit them for a while, things would die down, you know, stuff like that. Then something would flare up again, and they'd start firing more, and we'd hit them again and go inside the rubber and then pull back and bring some more air support and stuff in. And we finally busted that thing by bringing the 155s up and firing direct fire into that bumper line, because, I mean, by the time we finally figured out what was going on, because we were blowing all the vegetation away from all this shit.
Mm.
So you could see it. And they finally brought the 155s up and fired armor-piercing direct fire.
Sounds very reminiscent of the Hurricane Forest.
Right. And that's how we finally busted those front bunkers and, you know, finally, I guess, killed enough of them. They decided they didn't want any more. But they put up a hell of a fight that day.
Did you deal a lot with the RPG fire?
A lot of RPG fire, but there again, I guess it's because we were always moving.
Mm-hmm.
They had a tough time, you know, hitting us unless we were stationary.
Mm.
And we learned a lot of stuff about that as far as, you know, the cab was the one that came up with the idea of putting the chain link fence out in front of the tracks.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of pictures of that.
And everything that was, you know, so the RPG would hit the... That was the thing we were worried most about at night in a night position.
Mm-hmm.
If you were online, was them slipping up and putting an RPG into a track.
Yes.
I've got one picture of a track that got a hit at night with an RPG, and it just cracked it wide open. But I've got a picture of my track, a road wheel on my track, and we were not even on the perimeter. We were sitting back inside the perimeter. They missed the track they were shooting at. RPG hit about 10 meters from my track. We were sitting sideways in the perimeter, and it threw stuff up and blew holes about this big round in the road wheel.
Wow.
And I took a picture of it because I was sleeping about 2 feet above that road wheel.
Wow.
If the guy had just had his aim up a little bit, you know, but didn't happen, you know. We didn't have a lot of RPG stuff, you know. There was enough of it, but it was like we were always slinging so much lead back. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got the first shot, and that was it, you know. And from that point on, you know, I've got somewhere, and y'all may have a series of them here, the Time Life Vietnam series.
Mm, yeah.
You need to look through those, because someplace in the back of one of those books, it shows an aerial photograph of one troop with 11th Cav lit up from the air.
Mm.
And it's awesome.
Really?
Because, I mean, you think about it. Once we went into our position and somebody got hit, we used to do mad minutes every once in a while. And you fire up everything you've got, and you got a lot of shit going out, you know. You're talking about 15 50 caliber machine guns and 30 M60s, you know, lighting up and everything going out. And that's
a lot of
lead, you know. And usually if we was doing a mad minute, everybody that wasn't on a gun was going to the perimeter and standing there and firing something else, too, you know. So just to get in on the play. But, you know, that's the thing that I was proudest about, I guess, about the Cav, because the tactics over there for us were essentially, if we got ambushed and a guy spotted where the heaviest concentration of fire was, if you were a track commander, you'd go on the net and go, have spotted heavy concentration of fire and turning into fire, come on line with me.
Mm.
And it didn't make any difference if the colonel was two tracks up.
Mm.
He would come on line with you and you'd attack. Because that's the way that, you know, there was no stopping, we'll fight them from here.
Right.
It's if they're over there and the heaviest concentration of fire is over there, turn everything that way and go right at them.
Mm.
You know, it's the old busting through an ambush deal, just like you do on a patrol. You go into the ambush because that's the best, fastest way out.
Yeah.
Don't try to run the length of it, turn into it and go through them. And that's what we did with the tracks. And consequently, you know, it didn't take... See where K-Troop got screwed up so bad, and I'll go back to this because I studied it, and there was a real mistake made that morning.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't but a couple of miles from our base camp.
Yeah.
Area that everybody was familiar with on the road, and I guess it was a captain, or it could have been a lieutenant. Anyway, the commander of K-Troop made a tactical error.
Mm.
He spotted double columns of Arbonnes walking down the side of the road.
Mm.
And didn't get on the radio and call to see if there were Arbonnes operating in that area.
Mm.
He assumed, because they were dressed in Arbonne uniforms, carrying Arbonne weapons, that they were Arbonnes.
Mm-hmm.
They were not Arbonnes.
Wow.
And he drove the troop in between them, and they turned on him, and the next thing you know, they pretty well decimated K-Troop.
Yeah.
Shot these guys off the tracks, even drove two of them away.
Hmm.
They were later found, you know, because they didn't know how to drive them good. And they threw tracks on them and shit, but, you know, they screwed up because, the, you know, standard operating procedure was to call and make sure that there were not... or were Arbonnes operating in the area, and he didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
He assumed, and they weren't Arbonnes. They were dressed in Arbonne uniforms, and they ambushed him big time.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's the sort of thing, you know. But other than that, you know, most of the stuff that we did and the battles that I know that the Cav fought in, you know, we kicked butt. Mm-hmm. You know, we captured some pretty high-ranking officers from the NVA, and they all knew our unit. In fact, here's one of my favorite stories from the Vietnam Center. Mm-hmm. When we did the thing here almost 3 years ago now, when they had the North Vietnamese officers come in, mm-hmm. the guy that they sent down from Washington to be the interpreter for this general that came over, the way I heard it, they wouldn't let him bring his aide. They sent this guy from Washington. Of course, a lot of us read into that political, probably intelligence officer, to kind of keep an eye on this general,
right.
You know, or whatever. But anyway, I was attending one of the seminars, and I've got this white shirt that's got a Black Horse patch on it. Mm-hmm. And so I walked in late on this seminar and sat down to the back, and just so happened I was sitting beside this interpreter. Mm-hmm. He was in just listening to whatever the seminar was. Evidently they didn't have anything going on. Mm-hmm. So it got time, the seminar was over and everybody's getting up to leave, and for whatever reason I turned this way and he turned towards me. Mm-hmm. And it was my first face to face with this guy, and I just kind of stuck out my hand and said, "Welcome to Lubbock," or "Welcome to Texas," or something. Mm-hmm. I was looking him right in the eye, and I saw him cut his eye down to to the patch on my shirt. And he looked back up at me, and he spoke broken English, but he goes, "Is that your unit?" And I said, "Yes, that was my Vietnam unit." And he looked back up at me again, and he said, "Good unit." And that's all he said and walked off.
Wow.
You know, but he was kind of gray-haired and stuff like that, and there's no doubt that he probably, you know, was out there and had fought, you know, against the Cav. But we captured documents and talked to guys that said that they had been told that if they saw that patch or, you know, saw that emblem, to disengage. You know, they did not want to fight us because, you know, we had a tendency to kick their butt, you know, at any given time. But I don't know, where are we at now? I mean, what are we?
Well, I don't know. Actually, I was going to ask what your opinion on the 113 was.
Oh, I didn't have enough knowledge at the time to really think one way or the other. I thought it was pretty good for what we had. You know, there were some areas they wouldn't operate in. You know, the rainy season, you had to be real careful where you drove them, but they worked well for us as we had them configured. You know, I know now that, you know, Lord, I wish we'd had Bradleys, you know, but or something. But the way we configured them and the way we used them, they were pretty good. You had to make sure your maintenance was good, that you kept your tracks tight, you know, that everything. But they worked well for us. You know, the guys later got the Sheridans, and I never had any experience with them, so I had no. You know, I've talked to some of the guys that really liked them and some guys that thought they were junk, you know, so, and everything at the reunions and stuff, I'll hear them talking, but I never saw one, so.
Yeah, they came in April of 60, January of 69.
Yeah. But I thought they were pretty good vehicles. I mean, it was our house, you know. Of course, the RPG had cut right through them, you know, they were not real good for stopping anything, you know, like an RPG. Mines, if it was a big mine, you know, I wouldn't want to be a driver. You know, that was, to me, that was the most dangerous position on the track. You know, small mine. I got blown off, you know, twice, I think, that we hit a just a small small road mine, and it just, you know, essentially blew the track off, and just, you know, riding on top, it just pitches you off, and, you know, and you're real sore and everything. But, you know,
did they tend to initiate ambushes like that?
No, that was mostly road shit stuff. You know, ambushes, usually they waited until you were in the jungle and everything like that, and that was usually initiated with an RPG or something like that. And like I said, immediately we turned and attacked and everything, so we pretty well kept them. They'd nailed something with a... There was one night that we were outposting the road for the 101st Airborne to move their base camp, and we were guarding a bridge, and they mortared at us to get us to come to this village that we could see and see that the mortars were coming out of there, and they planted a real big mine. And I think like the third track, first two tracks missed it, and the third track hit it, and it blew it all to hell and everything. And that was a setup deal, you know, that they had set up because they hauled ass, you know, there wasn't any. And we found out later that the villagers, you know, when the mortar platoon came in, you know, they all went and hid, you know, because they knew. Because we blew the shit out of the village, you know, after the mine went off and everything. We didn't kill a civilian one. You know, we didn't kill any enemy either. Because they just, they dropped those mortars to get us moving their way. And that mine sat there to, you know, I guess they was hoping that they might get, like, the lead command track or, you know, that one of the officers' tracks would be in the front or something, you know. Cause it definitely, I think they said it was like an unexploded 750-pound bomb that they had,
I heard buried a lot
and,
of that.
And set it up, you know, and everything. So, but I really, I don't know, I talked to guys at the reunions and stuff like that, and I really, in a lot of ways, I had a fairly uneventful year. You know, Tet was a big deal. That battle we got into in May was a big deal. Of course, getting wounded that time was a big deal. But actually, the wounds got infected, and I spent more time in the hospital from the infection, trying to get rid of the infection, than anything that came of the wounds. But most of the stuff other than that was just peddling stuff, you know. We'd have snipers that would be in a position and shoot at us, and half the time they wouldn't hit anything. We had one that show up every afternoon about 2 o'clock and fire about 10 or 15 rounds, and to the best of our knowledge, he never hit anything for 5 days. So we figured he was, by the third day, everybody just wouldn't even stop what they were doing, just, you know, ping, you know, and it was, you'd hear it go over, you know, about 10-15 foot up. You know, and he was just, I guess his job was to come out and shoot at us, and he was making sure he didn't hit anybody, because he didn't want to piss nobody off, you know, is what we figured. But, you know, it was kind of one of those things that just, I don't know. I look back on it now and realize that, you know, it was an experience that I would never want to do again. But in a way, I wouldn't take anything for it either. And I'm still looking for 10 of those other 11 guys that I served with on the FO tracks. I found one of them mm-hmm. here several years ago at one of the reunions. I finally ran into Brown, who was one of the drivers, mm-hmm. and everything. But and he's the same way, because my mother made a bunch of black scarves and put gold braid on them and sent them over to us, and the 12 of us that were kind of all in my era, mm-hmm. you know, and everything, had those scarves, and I've never found, for years and years, I hadn't found anybody, and then I found Brown. You know, and I keep going to the reunions hoping I'll find one of those other guys, because several of those guys were from Texas and stuff, and, you know, I don't know where any of them, and some of them I don't remember anything but their nicknames, you know, because we all had nicknames. That's where I got, my nickname was Kahuna, mm-hmm. and we had this Hawaiian first sergeant that took over, you know, kind of in rotation like I did, and he said, you've got to be a kahuna because you go on these dismounts and y'all get into ship and you come back without a scratch, you know, and it kind of stuck, and I started using it for my radio call sign. I was 9 or 2 kahuna. I have run into guys at veterans reunions, just big veterans functions, and you get to talking radio call signs, and I've run into 2 or 3 guys that I've talked to on the radio, never met them.
Wow.
The time I was over there, but you start talking about call signs, you know, and you'll remember, you know, a call sign that you talked to, you know, because if we were operating with the 1st Infantry, of course, I'd be talking to their people a lot or whatever, so... Sometimes you talk to these guys and you'd never meet them, you know, but you remember those call signs and stuff. But it was an experience. Of course, the joke in my hometown was, is I came back from Vietnam 2 weeks after I was back, I broke my neck.
Oh.
And that's how I ended up in the CBR stuff that I was telling you, because by the time I went through all the stuff and operation and everything with a broken neck, and I got to Fort Carson, Colorado, that I was wearing a collar and wasn't supposed to lift over 5 pounds, and they didn't know what to do with me, so they sent me to battalion, and I became a battalion CBR NCO. And that was another thing that probably decided me that I didn't want to stay in the Army, because my tactical job at Fort Carson was in case of nuclear attack, to put on a hot suit and go check radiation levels.
Oh, that's got to be fun.
And, you know, you're talking the Air Force Academy, Fort Carson. There was an Air Force base there in Cheyenne Mountain, 2 miles away, which if you know what Cheyenne Mountain
NORAD,
is, it's NORAD, and the Russians knew it was there. And I told the colonel, I said, let me tell you what the radiation level is going to be in case of nuclear attack. It's going to be 100% for 1,000 years. You know, because I said they're going to drop 15 nukes over this whole area. There'd be a big hole in the ground where Fort Carson and Colorado Springs used to be.
Yeah.
And it'll be glowing for about 1,000 years. You know, but that's typical Army, you know. What? You know, yeah, go put on a hot suit, go check the radiation. I had this poster in my office up there. It's really neat. I wish I still had it. It looked like an official... you saw on these posters about things to do in case of nuclear attack, and it lined out all this, you know, fill your bathtub full of water, blah, 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 do this, do that, do that. And down at the bottom it says, bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. It was beautiful.
Yes.
You know, and I had that up and had it posted on the wall in my office, because I told the colonel, I said, here I am up on the 2nd floor of this building. I said, there'll be a big white flash. And I said, I'll have just enough time to do what that poster says right there, you know, before I'm vapor, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just, after serving with the cab, and see, we had such good officers. We had good NCOs. Everybody did their job. We had no racial tensions that I can remember. In fact, for a long time, the right machine gunner on 902 track was this guy named Mac, who was a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were just like this, you know. We were tight and everything, because he watched my back, I watched his back and everything. But after being in that type of unit, and then I get back to I can't even remember the unit I served with at Fort Carson.
Mm-hmm.
Could care less. It was some infantry battalion with the 5th Mechanized Infantry, mm-hmm. you know, and everything. And they were idiots, you mm-hmm. know, and everything. And I don't know, just couldn't stand it, because, you know, in the cab, as long as you did your job and you did what you were supposed to and everything, and kept your weapons clean and were ready to go and had your shit together, the officers didn't jack with us.
Mm.
You know, we drank with them. I mean, I didn't go to the officers' club, but sometimes they came over to the NCO club, and if they did, you know, it was welcome in and sit down and have a drink. Or if we were in the field and everything, you know, we might have a little nip, you know, or something like that. There's been several times over there that the colonel broke out a bottle and talked, and just everybody took a little nip, you know, because of whatever reason. But, you know, it was that type of unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a combat unit that was good and knew it, and if you weren't good, officer or otherwise, you'd suddenly look up and somebody'd be gone.
Right.
You know, we had one colonel relieved. We were up in, in fact, I think this was prior to Ted. That's the thing. I wish I'd kept a diary.
Mm.
That's the one thing that I'm sorriest about, that I didn't keep a diary of day-to-day events, so I could, you know, chronologically in my head know exactly what fell where.
Mm.
But we went out on a resupply run to La Caye just to get stuff we needed, you know. And one of the things you don't ever do is when you bust a trail, you don't ever come back on that same trail.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were coming back that evening, we'd gotten a little late leaving La Caye, and this colonel ordered us to come back in on the trail we went out on.
Mm.
And they had it mined in and booby-trapped in.
Mm.
And we got hung up, you know, and had to stop and essentially get guys off the track and start looking for mines and booby traps and stuff. And it got after dark and everything. And finally, what they did is they brought in Spooky, and we buttoned up, and he covered the area all around us, you know, with his guns, and set off a bunch of shit. And we came on in, but they flew him out before we ever hit, because there were guys on that convoy that would have shot his ass, you know, because we knew that wasn't right, and everything. And they had him flown out in a helicopter before the convoy ever hit the logging position, because, and we never saw him again, you know, because it was, and I'm sure, you know, when the regimental colonel, you know, by the time all this shit started and he started asking some questions and found out that he had ordered us, you know, they probably flew him out then, you know, and everything. But he disappeared, never to be seen again in the 11th Army Cav. But we had officers that, you know, led. That's just like I was telling you, that thing at Block A, the colonel climbed on either the second or third tank.
Mm.
Instead of flying in the helicopter on in above us, he led us into 2nd Field Force. And that's the way that's the way our officers did. So I felt like I had such a good unit and everything. I got back stateside, and I don't know, I might have gone to another post and I might have stayed in, but Fort Carson was so rickety-tick, so Mickey Mouse. They would not let you bring a car on that post if there was a peace symbol on the car. You know, and of course, Southern Colorado State College is there in Colorado Springs, and it's kind of a rich kids college anyway, and a bunch of hippies, and you know, we used to laugh and joke. You'd see these people panhandling on the street, and it'd get dark, and they'd get up from where they'd been panhandling, walk around the car corner, and get in a Mercedes and drive off, you know.
That's funny.
And shit. But I, by that time, thought that was kind of stupid, too, you know. I didn't have anything for Jane Fonda or any of that shit, but at the same time, I did not believe that people that honestly felt like they were against the war, they had a right to protest if they chose, you know, because to me, that's, who is it that said, I may not believe in what you say, but I will defend the death of the right to say it, you know, and that's what we as soldiers do,
right.
You know, we have a right to protest in this country and everything, and so I don't know, my views were changing. I guess I was seeing by that time that it was kind of a futile.
But when you were back in country, I mean, were you aware of the anti-war sentiment?
We heard some of it, you know. There again, you're talking 1968, so you know, it's like I told people, I came home to East Texas.
Mm.
I didn't get spit on.
Mm.
I got met more with indifference, you know, of I don't really care about that. That's not something I want to hear anything about.
Mm.
I just, even my own parents said, it's over, you survive, forget it, go on with your life, you know. And in a lot of ways, I thought I did, you know, to some extent. And everything just kind of blew it off because nobody wanted to hear it.
Mm.
You know, few friends that I had in Longview and this and that and the other that hadn't gone in the service, you know, they were into other things and stuff like that. I was, you know, by this time I knew that I was going to probably get out of the Army eventually and go back to college, you know, do something different. I'd blown 2 semesters of my parents' money. I joined the Army in a lot of ways, too, because if you joined, at the time I joined, for every month you served, you got a month of college.
Mm.
Now, they changed that law a year or so after I was in, where even the draftees got 36 months of college. They made it a month and a half of college for every month served. But when I joined, you figure 4 9-month semesters is 36 months. 36 months is 3 years, so I joined for 3 years, you know, because that way I would get paid 36 months of college. I mean, I didn't want to get kicked out of college. I know that was stupid, you know, and everything, but it was just, I was young and stupid then, you know, and everything. And once I did get out and go back to school, you know, I got my degree and everything. I changed degrees, but, you know, so it took me a little longer. But the bottom line is I got my degree and did pretty much, you know, I had a little help from my parents, but I did most of it myself, you know. So it was one of those things that, you know, at the time, that all figured into the factors, okay. You know, if you go in for as drafted, you're only going to get 2 years of college paid, or you know, 3 years or something like that. But otherwise, you'll get the full 36 months. So it's kind of one of those things. And of course, you know, I was into the alcohol pretty heavy, and that's how I broke my neck. Mm. And you know, I tried for years to blame my alcohol and my drinking on Vietnam, but it wasn't really, you know, because I'm an alcoholic, and that started a long time before Vietnam and everything, and just probably got aggravated by Vietnam because we had access to liquor more readily than other guys did, and stuff like that, and could carry it with us. So I probably drank more over in Vietnam than maybe a lot of guys did, you know, and continued that on then after I got back and everything. But
was there a lot of alcohol and drug abuse in country?
There wasn't. We smoked marijuana over there when we knew that we weren't going anywhere. We would have probably just beat the snot out of somebody that was stoned on a patrol or anything like that. Now, I have to honestly admit, we had a couple of guys that seemed to function on it. And there again, it goes back to that, if you do your job, nobody gives a shit. I mean, I had one driver for a while that if shit started and stuff like that, and something, he'd reach in his pocket and light a joint and be smoking a joint, you know. And, but he did everything he was supposed to, you know. It wasn't like he was a stoner and completely out of it or anything, but that's all I saw. I never saw heroin. We had opium a couple of times, you know, and that was like one of those things to try, you know. But, and there was moderate alcohol drinking, but there again, the same thing. You never saw anybody get shit-faced unless we were in base camp and knew that we were standing down for a couple of days.
Right.
And then people got shit-faced and stuff like that, but you know, but even if you had two or three beers, you know, at night or something like that, you'd be surprised how mortars coming in or something happening would wake everybody up and sober everybody up, you know, and stuff. So it was not what you'd call a problem, you know. We never had any problems with it. Probably the closest to a problem we had one time was a guy coming in from the club when we were in base camp and standing down. And this happened in a hooch, several hooches over from me. And most of us had already gone to bed, and all of a sudden this 45 is going off, you know, and everybody's up and trying to figure out what's going on. And finally, when it was click, 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 people went back into the hooch, and what we found out is this guy had walked in from the club pretty shit-faced and had gotten a care package from home. And his story was, is he saw this rat sitting on top of this package with a cookie in its fist, and one of his cookies from his mama. And he took a shot at this rat, and of course blew a hole in his cot and the package too, probably. But he claimed that this rat kept jumping up behind shit, grinning at him, and he kept shooting at him. He blew holes in the floor and the side of the hooch and the whole nine yards until he ran out of ammo and never did hit the rat. You know, of course.
We're about to run out of CD here.
It's probably stopping place anyway.
Okay, this will officially end the first interview with Mr. James Holt. Okay, this is Jonathan Bernstein continuing the interview with Mr. Jim Holt. We're at Mr. Holt's house. It is February 23rd, 2002, at approximately 1:50 p.m. Now, Mr. Holt, just had some questions for you about the OCS prep class that you were in at Fort Sill. Basically, we went over a basic overview of it last time. So I'm trying to get, I guess, your impressions of it.
Well, I'll tell you quite truthfully, at first I didn't like it at all.
Really?
You know, because I thought the impression I had gotten in basic training was AIT was going to be more a individual type training where there wouldn't be as much, I guess you'd say, BS as you got from the drill instructors in basic, and you know, might be a little more relaxed. Mm-hmm. And this was very intense because right. we didn't have NCOs, we had second lieutenants directly out of Fort Sill OCS that were essentially our instructors and over our platoons, and very intense, and there were like, you really didn't find out until about your sixth week that you became an upperclassman and you were responsible for so many of maybe someone that was coming behind you, because it kind of went through in cycles. You didn't all graduate at the same time. When we were put together, it seemed like we had some of the guys in the platoon had already been there a while, you know, and of course didn't know what that was, but you had to run everywhere, you know, real intense PT, you know, essentially almost the same stuff that the OCS guys did as far as the physical stuff, with the exception that our academics were different, because we went to class most of the day. We didn't have guys pulling KP. They had civilians that came in and actually did the KP because we were in class and everything. And of course, all of us there were training to be essentially fire direction control. We learned that. We learned calling in artillery, you know, basics, not as intense as the OCS guys, but all of us got to go out to the range and call in some artillery and, you know, basic sort of stuff. But every morning you were up at, you know, the crack of dawn. I can't remember. It seemed like, I want to say 4 o'clock, but maybe 4:30, somewhere around in there. And we were up running and everything. And so I didn't like it at all, you know. And supposedly it was one of those things that you could quit. But every time you tried to quit, it seemed like one of these older guys in the platoon had talked you out of it, or come around and talk to you and tell you to push on through. And the thing that I remember is somebody messed up one morning. The lieutenant came in to inspect the barracks just about as soon as everybody got up, because we had to be inspection ready all the time. And he came in to inspect, and somebody had messed up, and he had the whole platoon out in the street outside the barracks doing push-ups. And to this day, to the best of my knowledge, nobody ever admitted that they started it, but somebody in the back of the platoon started singing the Mickey Mouse Club song. And everybody took it up, and the lieutenant kept us doing push-ups until finally nobody in the platoon could push up anymore. We were all laying out there on our bellies, but we were still singing. And from that point on, we were kind of a unit. You know, we started working together. I made a lot of beds for a lot of people because I was real good at making a good tight rack. And other guys that were good at spit shining boots, you know, would spit shine other people's boots. And we just kind of formed as a unit after that. But it wasn't until the sixth week that I found out that, you know, that I had become an upperclassman, and then I was going to be responsible for some of these new guys coming in to kind of guide them along and stuff. But I learned a lot from it and everything, and I think it was a good experiment. I've only run into one person that ever remembers it, and he works for Texas Tech. I'm trying to see. I think I've got his card someplace here. I met him at one of our meetings over there at Texas Tech, and he just happened to hear me talking about this OCS prep, and he said that I was the first person that he'd ever run into that remembered it either, you know, because I don't know if they continued it for any length of time or decided it was a bad experiment or something, because this was like, oh, October, November, December, somewhere around in there of 1967. Okay. And I don't know, you know, I've never pursued it to find out if it was something that they continued doing for several years or multiple years, or just, you know, did it for 6 months and decided it wasn't working and everything. But I didn't like it at all at first, because I felt like it was more Mickey Mouse stuff, and of course these officers were real tough on us, you know, and everything had to be just so. Our uniforms had to be perfect, just like OCS. Our brass had to be shined perfect, you know. Everything was real, real strict, and I hated it at first, but I finally got good at it, you know, and it probably made me a better soldier, you know, because I learned to take care of my equipment better and various things like that. And then, of course, you know, when I got to Vietnam, well, I actually was assigned to Howitzer Battery, and for a little while actually worked in fire direction control, but then went from that to what we call the recon tracks and everything, and got into that where we did more of the recon and forward observer type stuff and everything. But I guess it was, you know, probably better for me. It would have been it was a whole lot better, I guess, than going. I was at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and if I'd gone across the street, that would have been Tigerland, and I'd have been right straight to Vietnam. And so as it was, I went through this AIT, and there were so many officers they sent in through OCS that they didn't have a place for me, so I actually went then to an artillery battery training guys to fire the guns and got a little experience further than that. So
now, was this OCS prep strictly for artillery officers, or was this just officers in general?
I have no idea. I think it was just strictly artillery, because it was there at Fort Sill, and that's really all I know about it, is the fact that they sent me. My orders were directly to this, and when I got there, you know, instead of being greeted by NCO drill instructors, I was greeted by second lieutenant, you know, and said, "I'm your mama," you know, and it was kind of scary. It's, oh no, you know, and of course, we all joke now as vets that there's nothing more dangerous than a second lieutenant with a little power, and that's kind of the way it was back then.
Yes.
You know, but it was overall, I guess, a good experience. Once we formed as a platoon, kind of, and started working together, we learned teamwork, obviously, and everything. And like I said, it did teach me some skills to take care of my equipment and do this and that and the other. But I don't know whether it was a continual experiment in the Army. I never pursued that.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned that your, I guess it was your company commander at SIL, gave you the rifle cleaning kit before heading over there. What were your thoughts at the time?
Well, quite frankly, I thought it was kind of dumb.
Really?
You know? I mean, I was, I guess, touched because, you know, he was nice enough to do something like that. And what he said made sense, you know, because, and everything. I took it home with me and took it to Vietnam and everything, and essentially thought about it when I was out in the field. Of course, there again, he didn't know where I was going to end up. And it being in an armored unit, we carried diesel and we carried all sorts of stuff that an infantryman couldn't carry.
Right.
So the only time I used the little kit was when I was on dismounted patrol and something like that, because on our track, we could break our weapons down and clean them in a big pan of diesel, you know, and just almost immerse them. You know, that's what we did with our 60s, is break them apart and immerse them in diesel, let them soak a while, and then get them out, wipe them down, clean them down, you know, use brushes and everything, but a lot easier to clean that way, you know. So I used this kit, but I'd like to find the guy if I ever knew where he was. I'd like to thank him because, you know, he just put something in my mind that you know, before you do anything else, clean your weapon.
What was his name?
Guerrero. Captain Guerrero. I'm not sure I could spell it correctly, but it's G-U-E-R-R-O or something like that. You know, he was a short, squat, broad-shouldered Hispanic, real rough-talking, you know, kind of gravelly-type voice. They said he'd gotten a field commission, you know, over in early in Vietnam, that he'd originally been a sergeant, and, you know, was Green Beret and had done something over there to get promoted, you know, to an officer, and was kind of that way, you know, like a Mustang officer, I guess, or whatever, got a field commission promotion. But he was quite a character. He'd get out. Of course, we were training these. That was their AIT, the guys training on the guns, and we were taking these cycles, and of course they had PT tests and stuff like that. Well, he'd get out and run the PT course backwards with these guys, you know, to show them that he was an old man, and of course, old man, he might have been late 20s, early 30s, you know, somewhere around in there, but to all of us, he was an older guy and stuff, but he was quite a character. He believed in his sergeants, his cadre, taking up for each other. You know, one of our sergeants, we had a sergeant that was real bad about getting in trouble and getting in fights. And one night, I was on CQ duty, and the captain walked in just about the time the phone rang, and it was one of the other sergeants telling me that this sergeant was in a fight at the downstairs of this club called the Pink Pussycat there in Lawton, Oklahoma, and was getting beat up on pretty bad. Well, the captain saw the look on my face, and the captain had just come from a party over at the colonels or the generals or someplace, and he was in, like, dress blues.
Wow.
You know, the dress mess uniform. And when I told him what was going on, he said, "Let's go." And he had a Corvette, and we jumped in this Corvette, and I think our company area was fairly close to the south gate of Fort Sill, and I think when we went through South Gate, we were doing about 80 miles an hour, and the MP didn't know whether to try to stop us or salute because he recognized the car, and we went blowing up in front of this club. And of course, in Oklahoma, a lot of the clubs were upstairs, downstairs, because upstairs you could drink 3-2 beer if you were under 21, between 18 and 21. Well, downstairs would be where if you were over 21, you could drink whiskey and stuff. So this, we knew it was happening downstairs, and the captain jumped out, and I was just following him, and we ran downstairs, and sure enough, there's a big commotion going over in the corner of this club, and our sergeant was over being beat on by about three guys. And this captain run over, and he grabbed one of them and turned him around and knocked him down. And another guy turned and was fixing to hit the captain, realized he was a captain, and hesitated, and should not have hesitated, because the captain nailed him, nailed the other guy. I'm standing there watching him just nail all three of them. I mean, it just happened just like that. You know, he picks his sergeant up, throws him over his shoulder. We go jump in his car upstairs, and as we're leaving, the MPs are going in the door. And we got back to the company area, and of course, he chewed this sergeant out, busted him down to corporal again. And the next day, he called all of us in and lined us up, the cadre, all the sergeants and the corporals, and I was just an acting corporal at the time. I think it was just a few weeks after that I got promoted to hard corporal. But he lined us all up and he said, this is the way it's going to be. If I have to go to the jail to pick up one of my cadre from this unit, he said, you better all be in jail if you were there. If one of you gets jumped on, he said, everybody better pile in. You know, that's the way he was, and that's what he believed. And he chewed on everybody pretty good, especially I think there were two guys with this sergeant that didn't jump into the fight. And he chewed on them real good, you know, and said, I don't care if I have to pick one of you up from the MPs and you're there and somebody's jumped on one of my cadre, he said, you better all be in jail, you know, because that's the way it has to be. You know, you protect each other. So that's kind of the way he was. He believed that, you know, everybody was a team, and that's, you know, it was very obvious that he was a good officer and he cared about his troops. You know, he was rough on the trainees, but, you know, you could also see that he cared about them. So I thought a lot of him. I've often wondered, you know, because he got his orders to go back to Vietnam about the same time I did. And I don't know where he ended up, you know. I think he was from New Mexico or someplace was where his family was or something. But I've always wondered. I looked for his name on the wall, and I didn't find it, or at least, you know, anything that's resembling him.
That's
so
encouraging.
I hope he made it. Yeah. You know, he's a good officer.
Yeah. So now, getting skipping ahead a little bit to arriving in Vietnam. Of course, your experience at 90th Replacement with your doctor. When you got there, I mean, granted, you had orders for 11th Cav, right?
Yeah, my orders actually, which I found out later, were fairly unusual.
Yeah.
My orders went directly from Fort Sill, Oklahoma to Black Horse, Long Gow Base Camp. Mm-hmm. I've still got a copy of those orders, you know.
Because that was definitely unusual from what I've heard.
Yeah.
Guys would be assigned to 25th Infantry and they'd get pulled off and go to the 4th
Division
or something like that.
Right. So I think probably what maybe precipitated my orders being followed more than anything else was because of K Troop, mm-hmm. 3rd Squadron, had gotten pretty well decimated a week or two, or, you know, I don't know if it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, a lot of the guys, I guess, with orders to 11th Cav had to go because they had to replace these guys that were either killed or wounded in this battle that K-Troop got in, because they did something real stupid and got theirself messed up real bad.
Mm-hmm.
But
That was with the supposed Arvin unit?
Yeah, took it in between the two columns of Arvins. Turned out it was NVA. But anyway, that's the only way I can figure it, because that's what I'd always heard, too, that you'd get over there, whether at Cameron Bay or 90th Replacement at Long Bend, and you might go anywhere, you know, no matter what your order said.
But
mine, like I said, I followed my orders all the way.
All right. The CAV training program, when you first got there, there were a couple other units that had done similar programs. What was it like there, I guess, getting you indoctrinated?
You know, I don't remember a lot of it. I mean, they gave us some classes. They showed us some booby traps. You know, they brought in a Vietnamese and showed him how easy he could sneak in, you know, through the wire. You know, it made an impact, but it was just everything was just everything was so new. You know, it was like I can't even remember. I guess the one thing I remember is them telling us to forget most of the stuff we'd been taught up to that point.
Really?
And listen to the old-timers. And see, just about at that time, everybody was in the field except for you know, your first sergeant, few clerks, and then guys that were either fixing to rotate to R&R or were back in recuperating from wounds or fixing to go back home. Because I was in the first group. The 11th Cav arrived in Vietnam in August of 66. And I'm arriving in July of 67. So I'm in the first group of replacements to replace the guys that came over on the boats. Because at our reunions now, see, there's the boat guys, and they're the ones that all went over on the boats and everything, the very first, and then, you know, everybody else. And I was kind of in that first wave of everybody else that arrived. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of people in our company area. There was, I think, one or two gun crews in because they were working on a couple of the guns and everything. And then, like I said, just a few of these guys that were recuperating or coming back or going to R&R. You know, there wasn't even a full tent. At that time, we didn't even have wooden hooches. We had just GP tents on a wooden floor platform. And I think in my tent, which was the artillery tent, you know, there was maybe only six guys where there would have normally been like 15 or 20 sleeping in that tent, you know, if everybody had been back and everything. So, you know, it was kind of like they sent us to some of these little classes, you know, and they were, you listened and you tried to learn what they were telling you, you know, but it was all, you know, a lot of what you were being told was you'll really learn once you hit the field, you know. And I really wasn't in, I don't guess I was in base camp but about a week, you know, and then I'm in a chopper headed out to the field, you know, so it wasn't any sort of lengthy class or anything like that. I don't think it was near as organized as maybe some of the other units had or stuff like that. You know, it wasn't real organized. You know, they just took you out and dropped you off out in the field. And of course, once I got to the field, well, then they went, okay, this is where the fire direction control guys sleep. You know, you're FDC trained, so, you know, they know and see what you've done up to then. You know, I'd had some radio training, some code training, stuff like that that I got at Fort Sill before I left and everything. So they immediately stuck me in FDC. And
would FDC be on a track? Or
no, actually, FDC normally, they had a track, but we would set up, you know, the tents that came off the back of a what we call the command APCs. They were the taller APCs. Yeah, I think they're 115s or something like that. I can't remember the nomenclature, but they would go out and set up, you know, where pretty close to wherever the guns were and everything, set that tent off. The interesting thing that we had that was just starting was this FADAC computer. They had the first computers where you didn't have to compute your logarithms, use your logarithm books to compute your firing data. You punched your data into this, oh, it was a huge thing, probably 4.5 foot by 4.5 foot that sat up on this table, you know, and real primitive, you know, but we just thought it was neat because we didn't have to flip through those log books and everything and look stuff up to compute our data, you know, and everything. It was all done for us. And they were using those over there and everything. But then, I don't remember the time span. It wasn't too long was when we got the new captain. And I can't even remember what the old captain's name was that was leaving, but we got this Captain Love, and he was from Dallas, and that's when he took a shine to me because I was from Longview, and so he wanted to make me his driver, you know. And I didn't really want any of it, you know, because the deal was is he rode in a Jeep with two antennas flying off of it, and all I could see was Dayglow Target,
yeah.
You know, and everything. But he thought he was doing me a favor, so I started screwing up and everything, and he kept promising me he's going to send me to the FO track, and that's right where I wanted to be, you know, because I was real gung-ho. And
did you tell him that's what you wanted?
Well, no, you know. I didn't want to hurt the guy's feelings and everything. I just had a tendency to just kind of, in a way, piss him off as often as I could until he finally got tired of me and sent me on to the FO track. It's kind of like Brer Rabbit and please don't throw me in that briar patch type of deal was kind of what I did. But I just couldn't see being his gopher for, you know, a year. I just, because he'd gotten there, you know, like I said, probably about the same time I did, really, but he was going through a different indoctrination than I was, of course, so we wouldn't have met up until he got to Howe Battery, but
well, I guess, I mean, you mentioned sort of, I guess, being gung-ho, wanting to get into the action. Any particular reason why movies, it's
the
state of the world?
I think it's growing up in a part of the United States where, you know, I grew up hunting and fishing and out in the woods and watching the John Wayne movies and, you know, and East Texas is kind of like West Texas. It's still patriotic and, you know, you support your country and you do what needs to be done and so I don't know. I just always, having spent a lot of my life being in choirs and being involved in music and excuse me. You on?
Yeah.
I think it's the way you're raised, as much as anything else. If I was going to be in Vietnam, you know, I wanted to be where the action was. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't particularly crazy in the fact that, you know, I was volunteering to go out on every patrol or, you know, or ambush patrol or stuff like that there was, but it's like my first dismount was, the reason why I volunteered to go on it was because everybody on the track just had a few weeks left in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the new guy, and I thought that was fair, you know, because I'd been on the, you know, out with them long enough that I felt like, you know, this was in September, so it'd been the July to September, and I'd had a couple of months, and so I thought I'd go and everything, and there were old timers going and stuff like that. So, you know, it was one of those things. But I don't know. I wanted to be involved in more action, you know, than because fire direction control. You're inside the kind of the squadron logger. You know, you're sitting back from where the tracks and tanks are out busting jungle and actually looking for stuff, and I wanted to be out there and everything, and I ended up getting out there, and there's a few times I wished I wasn't out there, you know, but I think I would have rather done that than been a year in fire direction control and stuff, because the thing is being in an armored unit, even the guns and the fire direction control was not like an infantry unit that was out someplace on a hill,
right?
You know, and could be attacked by large NVA unit or something like that. I think early on, the first year that the CAB was in Vietnam, the NVA tried to attack some night logger positions and found out that was not a good idea because, you know, you're talking about a position that's ringed with tanks and tracks with 50s and 60s and tank guns and stuff like that. And we kind of had a tradition that once we went into our circle, there's never been an enemy inside, you know, and never will be, because interlocking fields of fire and stuff like that, it was pretty difficult for them. So they didn't bother, you know, those positions very much. So mortars, you know, you got mortared there, occasional RPGs fired into the perimeter. And I guess it was after I left, because we didn't do it when I was there, but it was sometime after I left that they figured out that they'd take these pieces of chain link fence and put them in front of the tracks. And the RPGs would hit the chain link fence and go off there instead of hitting the track. That we didn't do that, but I heard guys talk that they started doing that later, and somebody thought of it, and it worked, you know, and turned out to be a real good tactic.
But did you do anything as far as sandbags on the exterior?
No. A few places where we got in some real rough areas and had the Rome plows with us, they actually would dig us a huge ditch that you could drive the track down into, and then we could drive down in there, and the guns would be sitting, you know, maybe about 5-6 inches above the ground, and then you had real good protection then, because they had to hit the guns directly with an RPG instead of, you know, driving them into the side of the tank. That was usually up in war zone D and C when we got up there that we did that, because that was a communist NVA infiltration area, and so we did that a few times, but not every time.
So were you mainly engaging the NVA units, or were there VC as
well? Oh, there was VC and NVA both. It seemed like after Tet that we engaged more NVA units, because a lot of the VC units were involved in the Tet offensive and kind of decimated out, you know, on their attacks in Saigon and this and that and the other. But the areas that we operate in, we had a tendency to run into more NVA units, because they were, number one, there were no civilians in the area to be VC, you know, unless it was one of the hardcore, you know, VC units. And then being in the infiltration route, that's what we hit a lot, was the NVA units coming in to move further on down south and everything. So it was a mix, you know. We could always tell, because if you hit somebody and you were getting sporadic small arms fire and not very disciplined fire, then it was usually a VC unit. But if you start getting a lot of heavy automatic weapons fire and RPGs, then you knew you'd tie it into the into the NVA. So it was a little both.
Now, during Tet, 96 miles in 12 hours, I guess, what was the sentiment getting into, or the feeling once you arrived at 2nd Field Force? I mean, what was the situation there?
Well, by the time we got to 2nd Field, it was late at night, you know, and everything, because it was after dinner when we started moving out, and it was late afternoon by the time we hit Lock K and actually left all our wheel vehicles. So to us, it was just kind of interesting. You know, they were glad to see us because, you know, this was the first major attack on any of those type of facilities. So you had all these guys in the bunker that were clerks and typists and various jobs like that, you know, had never, with the exception of a few mortars and maybe some rockets from time to time, had never really experienced any sort of concentrated attack. And to them, they were real scared, and we were all just kind of milling around waiting to see what was going to go on, you know, because We didn't really hit anything but some sniper fire and stuff coming through and everything, so it was kind of like a holiday for us. We were standing around on top of the tracks and looking around, you know, and I think, like I said before, somebody found the swimming pool, and we all went up and took a bath because we didn't know they had showers, you know. We thought the swimming pool would work real good, and the showers were a real plus the next day. But so to us, it was kind of like a holiday, and there were serious parts of it. My unit didn't ever really tie into anything real tough. Some of the line units actually went out and hit some pockets of pretty heavy resistance and had some pretty good little intense, you know, firefights in areas of the city. But in fact, my track spent most of the time there making water runs. We hitch a 500-gallon water trailer on it because they did destroy a lot of the facilities and stuff, the water points and stuff like that. And we actually, once we moved to the Cholon section of Saigon, which was the Chinese section, and we were set up on the river, well, we would have to go in once a day and use a green garden hose at one of the surgical hospitals in downtown Saigon to fill up this 500-gallon water trailer for water. And it'd take forever. But, you know, broad daylight, downtown Saigon, we'd leave one guy on the 50 on the track and the rest of us go find girls or bars or whatever, you know, so it was like a party, you know. Somebody'd come back and relieve the guy on the track so he could go, you know, and it'd take 2 or 3 hours to fill this water trailer up. So I did that a lot, you know, every day, making these water runs and going back. And of course, we caught some sampans one night coming down the Saigon River, and we had one of the dusters from one of the mechanized artillery or mechanized infantry units where they had these quad 50s mounted on the back of a 5-ton truck.
Okay.
And we had two of those with us, and they let these three or four sampans get like in between these two dusters and then just opened up and made confetti out of about 3 or 4 sampans. There wasn't even enough, you know, to see what it was. They got some secondary explosion off of it, though, so they were carrying ammunition or something, you know, but they tried to sneak past us and didn't know we were there, and we messed them up. But mostly it was kind of boring, really, you know.
Yeah, I remembered one of our first conversations, you mentioned driving down one of the streets in Saigon and just sort of sweeping the windows with the 60.
Yeah, that was that night.
Okay.
Coming through, because we caused some fire out of one of the buildings, you know, and that's what they told us, just return fire and keep going.
Okay, so you were actually firing.
And everything, so I'm trying to remember which one of these has the... This is the main one. There's my induction physical and my statement of acceptability and my orders to report for induction. I kept everything. It's my first picture and basic. And it was my vehicle identification card. I think I told you about taking the driver's exam.
Test. Yeah.
Well, I was a strapped troop, wasn't I? I'm afraid to look like Freddie Fluffdry. But there's my orders.
Fort
7 June, Fort Sill, Black Horse Base Camp.
Huh.
Benoit, Oakland, California. Went from Fort Sill to Longview. That's where I live.
Wow.
And right straight on through.
Interesting.
And everything.
they gave us some of this stuff when we got to Vietnam. I think that was stuff from the
Standard Orders of Rogers Rangers.
Yeah, that was. They gave those to everybody.
Really?
Yeah. Which I always kept. I thought these are the first pictures of base camp when we were still in tents. I bought a little Polaroid camera, various things about the cab and the stuff we did. That was a church service that was out in the field that we did.
Wow.
And then, see, here's how we clean the weapons. We just put the trim vane down on the front of the track, and we had diesel in these cans, some of them. We'd break them down and clean them out. And there was my track, and some of the guys, this was horsing around back at base camp after we got back. We actually had wooden hooches, you can see now on those. That's how it get in the rainy season with the mud. I mean, I got one in here someplace in the helicopter, and one of the little bubble choppers, and here he is right there. And that's the only place he can sit down, right there on that little
a little dress.
Yeah, there's my quarters for my Purple Heart and everything. I was with A Troop when I was wounded and everything, which I thought was kind of funny because they had me as also a member of A Troop.
That was with the commandant in native mind?
Yeah. And see, it says 27 September, but it was actually the 24th because it was my when we were wounded. That's evidently when they cut the orders because 24th is my birthday. It's 21st birthday. This, I wish we could find this girl. When I was in the hospital at our base camp, they... this little baby, and they nicknamed her Peaches, and she was 11 months old, and one of the doctors adopted her and took her home because she had no, you know, she her wrist had been shot out and and everything, and they tried to save her hand and everything, but this Rafferty that... Major Johnny Rafferty is a doctor, and he adopted her and everything. And I've always wondered if we could find her and find him and get her to one of our reunions.
That'd be great.
This is Hong Kong. I went there on R&R because I was still... my wound had gotten infected, and I lost quite a bit of weight. And so they sent me on to R&R. Now, I'll never forget the... company clerk didn't record it as such, and I got another R&R.
Oh, really?
I kept my mouth shut. And,
that's great.
And everything, but these are various battles that went on. Part of our unit, I think, assisted in the Battle of Loc Ninh and stuff like that.
Doc Tu.
Yeah. Some of it we weren't really in, but I cut out stuff that I thought was interesting. I wish I'd have kept a lot more of these. We had papers over there that they put guys' poems and thoughts and stuff in, and I had a whole bunch of them at one time, and I wish I'd have kept more. Cause, see, this is when we started building the hooches then, back in base camp and everything. That was the Hawaiian first sergeant that gave me the nickname Kahuna.
Okay.
And that was fire direction control back in base camp. That was our FDC. They could have hit that with a rocket and not messed it up and everything. This was when the 101st Airborne came in, and we were outposting the LZ for them. I found a guy later. I can't remember which one of these it was. It's one of these pictures. Must be that one right there. I was at a reunion. Everybody takes their books and lays them around where people can look at them. And I was looking at this one guy's book, and he has the same picture.
Really?
And he and I got to talking, and he must have been standing like right over here, and I'm standing here. Because it's the exact same choppers, the trees, you know, this log thing.
Uh-huh.
He's got, you know, like maybe this much of it, and I've got a little more over this way. We just cracked up, you know, because we didn't even know each other, evidently. But that's kind of how we lived out of our track. That's our track. And we'd get off at the end of a road march someplace and put a water can under the under the ramp, you know, and everything. And this was me here leaving on a long-range patrol with some guys.
Oh.
This was the Mountain Yards. This is when we was working with the Special Forces. We got up in an area in War Zone D where they had spotted some Russian tanks.
Mm-hmm.
This chopper is crashing.
Oh, really?
And I just threw up my camera and caught it. He was auto-rotating in.
Uh-huh.
He'd lost power. And nobody got hurt. He came in and bounced. And there it is.
Oof.
And they bring it in and hook up.
Uh-huh.
And just pick it up and lift it on out. Take it back to fix it. And that's an AVLB, one of the one of the bridges that they have. One of our guys, we give him a hard time because he left one over there. We got on. I think it was during the Cambodian invasion or something. Mm. But they were in a hurry and a rush, you know, and they threw it down. And he didn't have time to pick it up.
Really?
And when they came out another way. And we had guys went back later and went to the place and they're still using it as a bridge.
Really?
They put side rails on the thing and the whole 9 yards. And we told him, the guy took video of it and said, you're going to have to go retrieve that. That's on your, you know.
I'm surprised the Army didn't make him pay
for it.
This
is that swimming pool I was telling you about.
Oh, wow.
After they cleaned it up and everything, had to drain it and get all the scum and stuff out of it. And then they started letting us use it. So, because that's during tents, see?
Wow.
But, you know, that's kind of how it was, because once we run everybody out of second field, it was just Tom again, you know, and you could kick back and relax. This is outskirts of Saigon, Long Bend, and everything. Some of the dock facilities, that's a thing to the Arvin there. That's some sort of military, because I'm sure they're all torn down now. Downtown, going through downtown Saigon and stuff. Those, some of these were taken when we were going in on those water runs that I was telling you about.
Wow.
This is when we were on the river that I was telling you about. So we were kind of just set up, and this was all town over here.
Okay.
And then back here was the river, and this was across the river. This is my track here. And we were just set up, and we were, you know, interdicting anything that's going down the river at night.
Okay.
And watching, you know, this village section over there during the daytime, but it was real calm during the day and everything. There's the dusters I was telling you about.
Ah, yeah.
Those. They'd gone out and found those someplace in Cholon, brought them in.
Wow.
But, boy, those things kick up, and you're talking about kicking some ass. 450s going.
Yeah.
That was a pet. Did I tell you that story about the little Vietnamese coming up and stealing this?
Oh, yes, you
iguana.
Did.
Iguana. That's the iguana. Yeah. That was that damn iguana that we chased all over.
Yeah.
This is a letter I wrote to the Dallas News from Vietnam in April of 68. Because it kind of pissed me off. They had a photograph of them. Of machine guns and M60 sitting on the Capitol in D.C. because they were having problems because of the riots of Dr. Martin Luther King and everything. And so I was real proud of that letter. They published it. This was my buddy that was killed, and I found out later he was killed in a battle that I fought in, and I probably saw his body.
Really?
And didn't even know it. His parents were bitter. This was up in the Iron Triangle someplace. with salted tree lime that we suspected some stuff. We got in and we found some rice. This was a track I was sleeping in.
Oh, is it the one the RPG hit?
Yeah. I was sleeping right here inside, and if you can see,
yeah.
The RPG blew
some
fragments burned through the road wheel.
Huh.
But it actually hit out here.
Uh-huh.
And then blew up into it, because if he'd aimed high enough,
right.
It'd probably mess me up big time.
Wow.
See, there's one thing that they dug, and they decided to move the perimeter out, so we just put a tent for this lieutenant that was working with us down in it. But that's what they do. They dig these things, and you could drive down in them and everything. There was a defector that we caught, one of the highest ranking defectors that had ever been caught.
Wow. Who was it?
He was Tran Van Dow.
Tran Colonel?
Yeah.
Wow.
Here's a B-52 strike, and even though we knew when it was supposed to hit and everything, you still wouldn't get anything. Wouldn't get the flash.
Wow.
Just the
caribou.
And see, that's how we'd set up a logger out in the field. That's
okay.
That's from the top,
uh-huh.
You know. And all around out here, see, is your outer perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And then spotted out at different places then would be your other stuff.
Okay.
You do it at random, because that way they couldn't. Couldn't be as easy to attack with mortars.
Okay.
This was a med cap we did in some village someplace.
Hmm. Did you do a lot of med caps?
We did them whenever we could. Mm-hmm. We didn't do a lot because we were mostly in areas where there wasn't any villages,
mm-hmm.
You know. But if we were operating, our medics would go out and do it. That was my area back in base camp. There's that clerk that didn't put me on this on the first R&R. I'd like to find him, thank you. See, there's the way the top was set up now.
Okay.
This was at Long Bend when we were set up there.
Yeah, that's a safety track, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, and we'd set up two or three of them all together, you know, so you'd have a big area out there that everybody could operate under.
Yeah.
And of course, we slept here.
Mm-hmm.
We just set our tents up there and everything. But this is back in base camp. I still like to find these guys, especially Mac here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was the left gunner and he was the right gunner. And he's from Georgia someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone to all the reunions, he's never turned up. I'd sure like to find him. And this is just some stuff from some magazines and stuff stuck in here when they arrived. That's when Pat took over.
Yeah.
And then that's my freedom bird.
Huh. I
started leaving to go home.
Yeah.
And kind of a transition base camp, Thompson Newt. That was in New Jersey, and I think that's coming over, and that's in New Jersey, kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, that way of the trip home. That gave me an idea of what you look like after a road march, how dirty you'd get and everything.
Yeah.
Then I cleaned up. This was some AKs that we captured here and everything. Notice the guy taking a shower with one of those shower buckets.
Oh,
I was
telling
you about back over there
behind.
They love those. And then, like I told you, I got back home and broke my neck. And then this is Fort Carson, that's where I went. Fort Carson, my training with CBR and shooting flamethrowers up there and everything. And then my final classification, 4A, that was the thing they gave us over there. That was my dates, 16th through the 9th. This was just about general stuff. It wasn't 11th Armored Cav. I've got a book someplace that, and it may be in here. It may be this hurricane. That's my, you know. I don't know what they thought they were doing there. I've never seen anything like that on any of our tracks. But
that's bizarre.
You know, but this is how ours was set up. Like that. Of course, we carried a lot more shit on the front and stacked everywhere. They cleaned it up. We usually had sea rations stuck everywhere and strapped down. But it's a pretty good little book about the various configurations of the
577.
Yeah, that's what those are. 577s. I couldn't think of
the. Did your track have a name?
No, not really.
Okay.
We flew the Texas flag and the Rebel flag off of the three recon track and first squadron, because there was four guys per track, three tracks, and out of the 12 of us, I think like seven came from Texas, and the other guys all came from the South. Mm-hmm. We had one guy, I think, that was from Chicago or someplace like that, but he'd been born in the South.
Oh, so really?
In fact, my mother, and I've got mine someplace around here. I'd like to dig it out and find it. Mother sent us some black silk scarves with gold braid on them, and we all had those that my mother made up for us, you know, that we wore and everything. But it was a good unit. I'll be forever thankful that I got the cab, because, you know, you can ask anybody that has any knowledge of Vietnam to name the top, probably the five top units, and 11 cab would be in that that five, you know, someplace, and one of them might put them 30 or stuff like that. But I think I could safely say that anybody would pick one of the, you know, the cab to be in the top five, because just the way they operated, the length of time they were over there, and, you know, we operated everywhere but the Delta, essentially, that couldn't operate down there. Our second squadron went on up to the DMZ and supported the Marines up there for a period of time.
Really?
In fact, most of the time that I was in Vietnam, the year that I was there, 2nd Squadron was at the DMZ, and then they finally pulled them back down, I think either during Tet or the aftermath, right after Tet, they came back down and everything. But it's a good unit. I was lucky to be with them instead of, you know, I've talked to a lot of guys from all these veteran things that I go to and stuff, you know, that hated their unit, or it's always talking about the blacks and the whites having troubles or stuff like that. We didn't have any of that, you know. It just didn't happen. And even talking to guys that were there after I was, you know, said that still didn't go on in our unit. You know, we were all 11th cab and proud of it. And if you were cab, then, you know, you were one of us.
So there was no tension as far as Martin Luther King?
There was a little, you know, but we talked it out.
Really?
You know, there were a couple of black guys on my track at the time that happened, and we sat down and talked about it, you know, and everything. But we were tight, you know, so, you know, I understood their feelings, you know, and stuff like that, and everything, and sympathized with them, you know, because I thought, I came from a prejudiced environment, you know, in a way, but I was raised, my mother worked, my dad worked, and I had a black mammy, and she was just like my mother, and I was raised with her, by her, and my parents, of course, and everything, and so I had a different view, you know. My mother was a county and state nurse. When I wasn't going to school, lots of times if she was going out to the black schools, I would go with her to help her do immunizations and stuff, and so she taught me, you know, that people were people. And my dad was always more prejudiced, you know, and stuff, and after Vietnam, the one thing that I would not allow him to do is use the term nigger in front of me, I jump him every time he came out with it, you know. So he finally got where he wouldn't say that around me, and that was about the only battle I ever won with my dad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and in a way, he didn't even mean anything by it.
Right.
You know, he wasn't like a Ku Klux Klanner or anything like that, but he just, that was the way he was raised, and he was born in 1902, and they were niggers, mm-hmm. you know, and that's all he knew. You know, so it was kind of one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, well, have you got everything you...
Yeah, I guess. We've been going for a while. It's been about an hour.
Yeah.
So, sure.
Let me show you what I got, just to show you some stuff, and then I need to go meet a friend of mine, if it's okay with you.
Sure. Sure.
If, you know, if you want to come back later, you're welcome anytime, John, because you know, if you think of something else, or maybe, you know, the next time I can come over there if there's something else you want to talk about. But I want to show you a lot of the stuff I've got around here that I'm going to try to give to the archives.
Okay.
I may, there's two shelves of books over there that I may go through and just keep. There's some of them that are actually given to me and signed and stuff like that that I may keep. But what I'm thinking of is, if I've got an application in for a job in Austin.
Hmm.
And if I get it, I don't see any need to move this stuff.
Okay.
You know, when it's already this close to tech,
right.
Then I may, you know, get you to come over some Saturday.